The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for The Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Scott Cooper, president-elect of the Pennsylvania Association for Justice, going to be here talking about the bill that passed the Pennsylvania legislature today. They call it joint and several. They call it the fair share bill. I call it a theft for those who are victims. Again, this is another big sloppy wet kiss to the big business special interests, and we will see what's going to happen going forward when we talk with Scott Cooper. Also, in the third hour, John Logan, professor and director of labor studies at the San Francisco State University, going to be talking about today being the day they passed the National Labor Relations Act and what the NLRA has done, what all of these attacks against the NLRB are, and where we go forward from this point. Also, I want to give congratulations to Governor Grover Norquist, the Pennsylvania unelected Pennsylvania governor, who basically going to get his wish: no new taxes, no increase in revenue for the citizens of the state of Pennsylvania. We're going to do all of this off the backs of the poor. We're going to do all of this off the backs of the children. We're going to do all of this off the backs of our future. So congratulations, Governor Norquist. You have got your wish. But I don't know if you saw it today, and I think only 90 people did, but our governor came out with a YouTube video that he called The Governor Unplugged, which is kind of funny considering it's on the computer, and if it were truly unplugged, you wouldn't be able to see it. But, a whole different... He came out and he said that, the additional revenue that's come in, this $600 million in additional revenue that's come into the state that they didn't plan for when they set their $27.3 billion cap, was just a blip. It was kind of a one-time thing. Maybe we can use it, maybe we can't. Just a blip, kind of like when you get your tax return back from the federal government, and your mortgage is due. Kind of like that, according to him. Personally, if you're depending on your federal tax return to pay your mortgage, you've got some serious budgeting problems above and beyond. But what he's saying is this additional $600 million, and some put that number higher, just a blip on the screen, just a blip. And I say, that blip could educate a bunch of kids. That blip could be the lifeline that saves some disabled folks, some seniors. Maybe this blip could be used to ease some of the pain as our economy grows and as we recover from this massive recession. So instead of sticking to this arbitrary number that our governor has pulled somewhere out of his southern region, you have to wonder what the mindset is. This this angry, self-absorbed, I'm not going to do anything for anyone kind of mentality that I think that's where this is coming from. And maybe you've got a different opinion. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. But this budget, they've adjourned for the evening. Nothing yet, no vote yet. So kind of interesting that since the Republicans control the entire process, there's really nothing the Democrats can do to slow this train down. They control, it's kind of interesting that it's running all the way to the end of the track. And John Baer, a guy who writes for the Philadelphia Daily News, had an interesting piece, an interesting kind of take on what's going on this whole budget thing. He says, "Know who's happiest about the no tax cut spending state budget plan by Governor Corbett and Republican lawmakers that are going to finalize this week? You know who the happiest people are?" He says he's a bartender in central Pennsylvania with guns, grown sons but no daughters, no living parents, and no real interest in any government reforms. He goes on to say, "I say this because what's cooking in the Capitol is a new law extending happy hour." And he says, "I'm not making this up, and we've talked about it. A new law allowing gun owners to blast away when feeling threatened. A new law certain to make obtaining abortions more difficult, and a new law likely to restrict elderly voters' access to the polling place. Plus, deep cuts in education and welfare won't affect him much." So, working, gun-owning, white barkeeps outside cities with no kids in school are happy, as is the natural gas industry, and, of course, Grover Norquist, our unelected governor. Republican control means pro-life until that life gets to school or needs social services. Anti-spending until you need $10 million for a vote your ID program clearly partisan motive, and pro-guns always. Real government or political reform? Well, maybe later, he says. Meanwhile, let's have a drink. And I look at this, and I look at the fact that education, getting whacked. I look at the fact that hospitals taking a whack. I look at the fact that, and we went through the budget today line by line. My producer went through line by line and picked out some gems like proposing cutting the Ethics Commission by $18,000. $19,000 may not sound like a lot, but over here with some of the ethics problems that are going on, remember this. These are the party of oversight. These are the people who are going to clean up government. When you start cutting the ethics budget, I have a problem with that. They're going to cut the legislative printing office by $3.5 million, which I guess if you're putting everything online, maybe not. But are you buying Pennsylvania paper? And if you were buying Pennsylvania paper, what's that going to mean to the jobs that were created by that? And if you weren't, why weren't you? They're also going to cut $718,000 for violence reduction and safe neighborhoods. $300,000, and then victims of juvenile crime by $718,000. Which, again, you know, they keep talking about, well, there are schools. Schools are in dangerous neighborhoods. So what we're going to do to fix those dangerous neighborhoods, we're going to take all the money out of it. Because, of course, you know, cutting funding for things makes things much better, makes neighborhoods safer, makes schools safer. I think that's the logic. If cutting spending creates jobs, cutting spending cuts crime. It's got to be the evolution of that talking point. They go on to cut $435,000 from they add $435,000 to non-public and charter schools. So we're going to cut money from the education budget. But we're going to hand it over to bussing kids around to private schools and to charter schools. Am I getting this right? Kind of has to make you wonder. We're cutting $1 billion to education. We're cutting a bunch of money to labor and industry, occupational safety, and industrial safety. We're cutting that as well, $833,000 there. We're cutting, 5.9 million to conservation corps, $4.4 million to homeless assistance, $2.2 million in services to people with disabilities, $8.5 million to child care services, and somewhere around $3.5 million or $35 million to the higher ed system. So good, deep, nice cuts. All of the the poor, all of the working class, those are the folks who took the whack. I didn't see anything on there about reeling in corporate special interests. I didn't see anything about closing Delaware loopholes. I didn't see anything about taxing drillers. I didn't see anything in there about how we're going to increase revenue. Just cut, cut, cut. Pain for you, pain for me. Just amazing stuff. And I want to check the library budget when we take a look at that, because, again, another one of those things that they don't think we need. And they just continue cut every year for the last several years. They have taken a cut with the library budget. And, you know, you look at this, and especially at a time when we need some of this stuff, the ethics thing just throws me. The massive cuts to DEP, another $10 million in cuts to the Department of Environmental Protection at a time when we're talking about adding more drillers. Yeah, come on, Pennsylvania's open for business. Stick your needles in our ground. Now, this is after several years of cuts. This didn't just happen. This has been a cycle. We seem to want to just take our complete control off of the environment and say, go ahead, you're the experts in this. You, the drillers, you're the experts. You can police yourself. We trust you. We trust you just like we trusted Wall Street. Don't worry about it. Everything is fine. Yet, you know, you stop and you look at the fact that we're cutting the number of employees from 2,900 down to 2,600. We're cutting money from, you know, every possible part of the DEP. The environmental program management budget slashed. The general budget slashed. You know, you look at the flood control budget slashed. The safe water program slashed. All of these programs slashed. So, if the drillers do have a blowout, if they do have a quote-unquote accident, or if, you know what, just in the general course of doing their business, they somehow screw up everybody's water, we probably won't know it. We may not see. We may, you know, they may be in a different part of the state. And the fact that we have a governor who seems to be hell-bent on defending this industry just kind of makes me concerned on so many levels. This budget is not so much about fairness and operating government in a responsible way as it is punishing the poor and rewarding the uber wealthy, rewarding the corporate form. And at the end of this, you and me, as is everything that my government teacher in high school said, you know, at the end of the day, Republicans are about big business and the wealthy. Democrats are about the poor and bigger government programs to help the poor. At the end of it, and he was right, those of you in the middle, those of you who are working your behinds off to try and get ahead, you're going to pay for both. And today, right here and now, we are benefiting people. We are paying for people who don't need the help at the expense of those who do. And, you know, he added that caveat, you know, decide which side of the equation you're on by how close you are to being the uber wealthy or how close you are to being that homeless guy. And I would argue that the majority of the people in this listening area and in this country, the majority are closer to being homeless than they are to being Warren Buffett. Closer to being that woman on the street the other day with the sign saying, I'm homeless, please help me. Than you are sitting on a yacht in the French Riviera. So at the end of this budget, horrible, horrible in nature. And this, at the end of the day, is what the Republicans brought you. So when your local taxes go through the roof, you know who to thank. When you see more homeless people on the street, you know who to thank. When you see 30, 40, 50, 60 kids in a classroom, you know who to thank, because the Democrats have no say here. If I were one of the Democrats, I wouldn't even be in the room. Not that they would let me, but I wouldn't even be in the building. What's the point? They have no voice. They have no say. They just nothing. They're tolerated to a point, and then, okay, we're done. We're cutting off debate, and we're going to ram through what we want anyway. Just look at that voter ID bill last week. Anyway, Let's take a quick break. When we come back, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. What are your thoughts of this budget? I'm curious. Right back after this.
Are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. California Governor Jerry Brown has two more days to decide if he'll sign into law a bill that would give farm workers the right to unionize. After making it through the legislature, the bill landed on the governor's desk June 16th, and there it has sat. This weekend, workers, politicians, labor leaders, and celebrities marched to the governor's office in Los Angeles to call for a signature on the bill. An additional contingent of supporters marched on the state capitol building in Sacramento. If ratified, the legislation would streamline the process for farm workers to unionize and provide greater protections from intimidation. Proponents of the legislation say it's necessary to ensure that laws currently on the books are enforced, as it'll provide farm workers with an amplified voice when it comes to basic necessities in the field, such as shade, water, and training, to prevent heat stroke. It will give workers a voice for when dangerous pesticides are being used above suggested limits in the fields, giving consumers a new line of defense before a product comes to market. It will additionally add a way for workers to report discrimination and sexual harassment without risking retribution. At the last minute, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker changed the location of his budget bill signing. Doug Cunningham reports.
Walker had picked the anti-union Badger Sheet Metal Works to sign his anti-union budget bill. But then something happened Friday that apparently shamed even the shameless Walker. News surfaced that the owner of that business, Greg DeCaster, served prison time in a federal tax evasion case. Walker changed the location of his budget signing on that news, but I asked David Goodspeed of Sheet Metal Workers Local 565 about Walker's choice of an anti-union business for his budget signing in the first place.
It's a symbolic measure on their part. They're going to continue poking at union people and trying to undermine the standard of living that union people have in this state. Hopefully the recalls can make a dent in their ability to influence legislation here in the state.
Primaries in the Wisconsin State Senate recalls will be held July 12th, with a regular recall election to follow August 9th. Recall action against Governor Walker can't happen until he's served in office a year, but an effort against him is coming in January. Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary for Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
That's what they're doing, taking the money and heading out of town. Frustrating stuff. Remember last week we talked about the Capgemini and Merrill Lynch World Wealth Report? Remember that? We talked about the fact that the globe now has some 103,000 high-wealth individual investors. Those are defined as people who have about $30 million rolling around in between the couch cushions. $30 million. $30 million rolling around in the couch cushions. That's not their net worth. That's just play money. That's the money that's rolling around in the couch, burning a hole in their pocket. Now, you do the math, and it comes out to together, these ultra-high net worth folks have some pretty serious coins, somewhere around $15 trillion in investable wealth. $15 trillion. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. And, you know, I went to a public high school, so according to the folks who want to destroy public education, I must not be that bright. But, again, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's more than the people in Greece owe. That's more than the U.S. owes. And if you add it together, $14.3 trillion is what they're saying we owe. Greece owes about $500 billion. You add it up, $14.8 billion. $15 billion for the top 103,000, $14.8 billion that the rest of us owe, kind of makes you wonder. You know, you got $200 million extra dollars there if we just took all of that. And you know what? If you stop and you look at it, if we did pay off the Greek and the U.S. debt, each one of those 103,000 people would still have $20 million just to play with. That's not the mansions, that's not the Bentleys, that's not the jewelry, that's not the caviar, that's not the, you know, the sailing up and down the French Riviera. No, it's none of that. That's just play money. But we can't tax any of that. We can't go after any of that. And 40% of those ultra-high net worth individuals are right here in the U.S., so we can't talk about that. In fact, Eric Cantor made a big production out of his planned storming out of the debt ceiling discussions last week. Again, they planned that for maximum political coverage. And they said, no, we're not going to go after those folks. No, we can't go after our ultra-high net worth individuals. No, no, no. It's easier to take food from the mouths of children and blame them for being hungry. It's easier to defund education and blame them for being stupid. It's easy to defund Medicare and blame Granny for getting sick. It's a lot easier to do that than it is to go after the folks who have been doing wildly well and have had all of the advantage of government pointed their way. You know, one of the very first things, and I go back to this, one of the very first things I learned in government class as a young man of 17, government decides who gets what, which is why so many people are ticked off at government. In fact, everybody, because you never get everything that you want unless you're the top 1%. And you can pay the high-priced lobbyists, and you can pay for congressmen, and you can pay for a judicial system to make sure that all the decisions go your way. And right now, that investment's paying off like none other. Corporate America has never been more profitable. The CEO seat has never been more profitable. The boardroom never more profitable. The shareholders, happy as can be. It's the workers who are getting screwed, and it's those poor people. And you look here on the state level, this budget's going to be painful. And the reality is it doesn't have to be. We've given away billions of dollars over the years in handouts to people who never needed them. You stop and look at the Marcellus Shale. We got people drilling our resource right out from under our feet, and we don't get a taste of it. Look at the Delaware loophole. They open up a post office box in another state, and there goes hundreds of millions of dollars that we will never see. Yet we're talking about gutting education. We're talking about allowing poor people and the disabled to suffer. But yes, we are still a Christian nation by all means. Yes, because I go to church on Sunday. That makes me wonderful. It's amazing stuff. And I look at Michelle Bachmann, who has announced she is running for president again. She's announced it again. I thought she announced it during the CNN debate where she was one of the seven dwarfs up on stage. Evidently, once was not enough. She had to go and announce it today. And I'm going to play this clip an awful lot tonight because I just think it's funny. She announces, and then she says something stupid, which you got to love stupid.
Well, what I want them to know is, just like John Wayne was from Waterloo, Iowa, that's just the kind of spirit that I have, too.
She's got the spirit of John Wayne. It's coming. It's just bubbling up from her innards. She's got the spirit of John Wayne. Problem is John Wayne was not from Waterloo, Iowa. John Wayne Gacy was. So not the hero that she was expecting. No, she's siding with it. She's got the spirit of a serial killer. Good for her. And, you know, I don't doubt it. If you look at some of the positions that she's taken, she was at this Constitutional Coalition conference this past weekend. She had to cancel out of the Republican Loony Conference. I mean the Tea Party Convention. After all, she can't look too crazy now after being knighted the Republican frontrunner. But she asked the question, is the country too big to fail? No, the country can fail. We can. We are not invisible. We're not invincible. What? We're not invincible? But I thought we were exceptional. I thought we were American exceptionalism. I thought we were wonderful. I thought we could do anything. Evidently, Michelle doesn't believe in American exceptionalism. She goes on to say, and we're so close to being to that point, because the thing is, as Glenn Beck said last night, it's true. Just what we need in this country. Glenn Beck as a presidential confidant and resource to be cited by a president. Doesn't that scare you? It scares the hell out of me. She says, you know, Glenn Beck was right. He was absolutely right. It's true. $107 trillion that he put on the board. We're $14 trillion in debt, but that doesn't include the unfunded massive liabilities. That's $107 trillion, and that's for Social Security and Medicare and all the rest. You add it up. You add up all those unfunded net liabilities and all the traps that could go wrong we're on the hook for. And what it means is what we have to do is reorganize all of that, Social Security and all. We have to do it simply because we can't let the contract remain as they are, because the older people are going to lose. Just so you know, she's talking about destroying Social Security and Medicare. I just want to make sure that's clear before we go on. She goes on to say, so what you have to do is keep faith with the people that are already in the system, that don't have any other options. We have to keep faith with them. But basically, what we have to do is wean everybody else off. And wean everybody else off because we have to take those unfunded net liabilities off our bank sheet. We can't do it. So we just have to be straight with the people. So basically, whoever our nominee is going to have to have a Glenn Beck chalkboard and explain to everyone the way it is. Kind of like Alan Simpson tried when he said that the government is like a big cow and has 310 million teats, and all these people are sucking off the government. Alan Simpson said we need to reorganize Social Security so it works like it used to, where you're dead 7-8 years before you can collect it. But this is it. I mean, this is the direction that they're taking. This is the Republican Party. And I look at this, Jake, and I say, you know, yeah, and you say it often to me, well, I got mine, which is the mentality that some people have about Social Security or Medicare. But at the end of the day, once they go after and they take away from me, and they realize it's not enough to take from me and take from the younger generations, they got to come back after you. And they got to come back after the people who are still collecting it, and they've got to squeeze it down, and they got to block grant Medicare so that they can squeeze you even more. And that's the game plan.
No, Social Security is not just about transferring the wealth to Wall Street. It's symbiotic of what they hate about government. It's the last vestige, and I've said this before, but I do believe it's true. It's the last vestige of FDR and some of those great government programs. The sad part about it is it just happens to be the most successful social program, not only in the United States, but clearly the most successful social program in the history of the world.
But at the end of the day, they can't have you with that kind of security. They just can't. It just can't happen. And what bothers me, we're not talking about taxing people who have it. At the beginning, I began this by saying there are 103,000 people with $15 trillion worth of investable assets. That would, if you took that away from them, it would not affect their standard of living whatsoever, one iota. I'm not advocating that, but what I'm saying is you should ask them to contribute more. You should tax them more. In fact, there are rich people in this country who are saying, please do that before the social unrest that they see coming happens. Independent Senator Bernie Sanders from Vermont today on the floor of the Senate said, at a time when the richest people and the largest corporations in our country are doing phenomenally well, and in many cases have had never had it so good, while the middle class is disappearing and poverty is increasing, it is absolutely imperative that a deficit reduction package not include the disastrous cuts in programs for working families, the elderly, the sick, the children, and the poor that the Republicans in Congress, dominated by the extreme right wing, are demanding. He said, instead of yielding to the incessant extreme Republican demands, as the president did during last December's tax cut agreement and this year's spending negotiation, the president has got to get out of the beltway and rally the American people who already believe that deficit reduction must be about shared sacrifice. And I absolutely agree. Look, we keep hearing that frame constantly out there. We need shared sacrifice. Need shared sacrifice. Yet I'm not seeing a small segment of the population sacrificing. And those are the people who have it the best. I mean, why would you, and this is what just boggles my mind. You know, why isn't there this huge hue and cry from the massive working class of this country asking why don't we ask Bill Gates or Warren Buffett or the billionaire class? Pitch in. Times are tough. We're all rolling up our sleeves. We're all getting our hands dirty. We're all tightening our belts. We're all, you know, having macaroni and cheese instead of steak. We're all pitching in to help. Why aren't they? That's the question we should be asking. And at the end of this, and this is what we have to remember next November of 2012, both on the state and on the national level, everything that's happening right now, all of this destruction, all of this pain, all of this suffering that is coming because of the Republicans. Because here in Harrisburg, Democrats don't have a voice, nothing. The only thing holding this up are a handful of Republicans who are going, whoa, this is getting a little crazy. That's the end of it. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Your thoughts right back after this.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show.
17th century playwright William Congreve must have been a seer, for he wrote that even in hell there is no fury like a woman scorned. Apparently, he foresaw the tempest now roaring out of the League of Women Voters. Long considered to be the church ladies of American politics, the group is best known for its sober voter education efforts. But pow! The ladies have suddenly shattered that stereotype by delivering a powerful political punch to a couple of U.S. senators, making clear to a startled Washington that they are not to be trifled with. LWV recently ran some hard-hitting TV ads taking Massachusetts Republican Scott Brown and Missouri Democrat Claire McCaskill to task for trying to weaken enforcement of clean air laws. "I was shocked," cried McCaskill. "To me, they have always been about civic engagement and debates." Well, hello, Senator. You've just been civically engaged by a group of feisty women who realized that their polite and earnest letter-writing efforts to lawmakers like you were not working. With both parties kowtowing to the money of corporate polluters, senators were simply ignoring the letters. So the group toughened up. Senator Brown whined that LWV's ad was an ambush, as though the little ladies should stick to their inoffensive knitting. Pathetically, he tried to retaliate with an impetuous video slapping at the women's credibility, whimpering that they, quote, have gone to the gutter with their negative ads. Get a grip, Scott. You voted to gut EPA's Clean Air Authority, So it's hardly gutter politics for a group of mothers and grandmothers to point that out to voters. You've also taken campaign cash from the lobbyists with whom you voted. So it's your credibility that's in question. This is Jim Hightower saying, how shocking that senators are shocked when they're called to account by fed-up voters like the League of Women Voters. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
And welcome back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. The governor came to agreements with the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Council 13, and also the Service Employees International Union, Local 668. Again, you know, with the times, not bad contracts for the workers, that they're going to be okay. But what I found interesting was the article in the paper today, talking about the administration having made no decisions yet about the state's management employees and what they're going to do to them. And again, you know, I go back to this and I say, you know, these are the reasons that people have contracts. This is the reason that you have collective bargaining agreements, that you have the ability to sit at a table and negotiate. You look at the management people, the 13,000 management employees, they're going to wait and see what is being imposed on them. Not by any great contract negotiations of their own, which is what I love. I love the right wing's take on this. Well, you know, I'll make my own deal. I'm going to sit down and negotiate my own contract. Well, there are 13,000 well-educated management employees who, for all intent and purposes, are waiting to see what's going to be imposed onto them. They're not going, Governor, I want to sit down and talk about my contract. I think that they would get the same treatment that the unfortunate folks in the wheelchairs got every time they came to talk with the governor. Ignored. So, again, you know, I go back to this, you know, just from a working person's point of view. And, you know, it's not that I'm taking any great joy at these 13,000 people being basically just hung out in the wind. And well, they'll figure out what they're going to get eventually. But it does highlight the fact that, you know, they don't have any say. It's what's imposed on them. And, you know, that frame that we keep hearing the right throwing out there. Well, you don't need unions. You don't need to collectively bargain. It's an infringement on your rights. We want to have a right to work state. It's kind of insane if you think about it. Where you want to take away people's rights. You want to use big government to take back the rights of others. It's amazing stuff. And I look at Apple. Apple Incorporated has been one of those companies that, you know, they've thrown out there as the benevolent corporation. Now, remember what I've said for the longest time. There's no such thing as a benevolent corporation. There's a corporation that is profiting off you, and while they're profiting off of you, they treat you pretty well. That's the best you can ask for. And they're pretty good to you. You know, while they're profitable, while they're doing okay, you know, times are good. Everybody's happy. As we saw in September of 2008, when things start to go south, when profits start to go down, when you start losing money, what happens? They start throwing people into the streets. Doesn't matter how good of an employee you've been. Doesn't matter how loyal, how dedicated. None of that matters. It's you're behind to the street to save money for the company. And that's what the right preaches as the right thing to do. And then they want to deny unemployment benefits, and they want to shrink the amount of resource and the amount of time. Because after all those people who got laid off in September of 08 and November and, you know, all those months, they all were lazy and stupid, shiftless. That's what they told us. So when I look at Apple, when I look at the employees at Apple starting a unionization drive, you kind of go, wait a second. But that's exactly what they've done. And again, it comes back to the core things that I talk about. Wages, hours, conditions. You know, what you're getting paid, you know, what kind of conditions, what kind of benefits, and what the hours are. And what I find fairly interesting is that, again, you're kind of seeing that pushback from the wonderful company. We'll be as benevolent to a point. And that's what gets me. I've never had anyone say, Rick, here's a job. We like you so much. Have you, Jake? Have you ever had, walking down the street and say, you have a kind look in your eye. I'm going to give you a job.
Did they ever recruit me? No. No. Never.
That's probably because you don't have a kind look in your eye.
Is that what the problem was? Okay.
But the reality is, and I go back to this, because what we're seeing is this push across the country, this massive push to steal rights away. And I've been really kind of, I've yet to have anyone explain to me a real good rationale for making Pennsylvania or any state a right-to-work state, considering the rules are what they are. You can be a Beck objector. In fact, the decision was. In fact, I think it was today, if I'm not mistaken, when the Supreme Court, or it's going to be tomorrow, when the Supreme Court ruled in CWA versus Beck versus CWA that you didn't have to join the union, but you did have to pay for representation. You did have to pay what the contract was going to cost, and that's fair. I mean, I don't think anyone should be able to get anything for free, just like I'm in favor of a mandate for health care. I don't think there should be free riders. But in looking at this, no one's made a real strong argument other than, I shouldn't have to pay for something if I don't want it. And then comes the, that I just won't take the benefits. Well, again, that's not an option. What a contract is it's an agreement between the employees as a whole, the group, and the employer. And what the right to work people really want to be able to do is take that right away from not only the workers as a whole, but the employer as well. I mean, workers have the right, if there's a union there, not to take the job. Every time that I've gone to an employer who has a union contract, the first thing they say is, we have an agreement with the union, you have to join. You have the ability to get up and walk out. Nobody is putting a gun to your head. But that's the way the right loves to spin this. Oh, the unions have a gun to your head. They're twisting your arm. That's never happened. But it makes for a good story. It makes for a good scare tactic.
I've had contact with the Pennsylvania Right to Work. I've seen them in action. I've actually been to the debates. And you're exactly right. They try to frame it as they're being benevolent to the workers. They're looking out for their rights. Well, all you got to do is look who's funding the Pennsylvania Right to Work Committee, and it's the Pennsylvania manufacturers, those people from the manufacturing sector, pretty much the big businesses within the state. And I love this framework. Well, we're here to protect these workers from the abuses of these bad
the big union boss.
Oh, don't you just love that?
And you look at this situation with the Apple workers. They're trying to start the Apple Retail Workers Union. Now, understand, in San Francisco, one of the most expensive cities in the country, the hourly wage is $9.92 an hour. $9.92. In some of the other places in San Francisco, some people make a little bit more, $14 an hour, in one of the most expensive cities in the country. Stop and think about the difference of resources in workers between $10 and $14 an hour trying to collect a big bargain against a company that's worth somewhere around $320 billion. Stop and think about the scale there. Who has the advantage? Let's see, maybe a couple hundred workers making $14 an hour, or a $300 billion Goliath, this monster. It's going to be interesting to see where this goes because, nationwide, they have somewhere around 30,000 employees, 30,000 retail employees in 325 stores around the world. So it's going to be interesting to see where this goes. That's the reason I brought it up, because what we're seeing is this attack. And right now, you've got people saying, well, hold on. we're getting screwed. And this is why I said from the beginning, President Obama should have passed the Employee Free Choice Act, would have given people the opportunity to step forward and say, you know what, while they're stealing wages from us, while they're stealing benefits from us, while they're destroying working conditions and all of that stuff, while being wildly profitable, we should be able to go to the bargaining table. We should be able to sit down and say, whoa, hold on. A 20% cut from a company who's making, you know, 40% profit, we should be talking about this. But much like the state management people, some 90% of the workforce is imposed upon. You will take this or you can leave. You will get this and you have no say. It's kind of an interesting scenario. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back after this.
For and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask me, Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280, or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Someone tell the GOP that Ohio's not for sale.
Here's the great thing about Ohio. If you want to think about it this way, the folks who keep telling us that if we cut government spending, all we got to do is we got to slash and burn. If we can cut government spending, we're going to create all these new jobs and we're going to save the country. That's the right wing frame. They don't have a plan. They didn't have a plan last November. You know, they kept saying in their grand pledge that their agenda was jobs, jobs, jobs. It has been anything but a jobs, jobs, jobs agenda. What it's been is it's been destroy as many jobs as possible and power through with the most radical right-wing agenda possible. So what we're seeing now is in those places where you've seen the deepest cuts, and understand, Pennsylvania is going to be one of these states very soon. In the places where they have slashed and burned, they have lost jobs. Governor Kasich in Ohio said, we're going to have to reduce spending to create a platform for economic growth. Chris Christie over in New Jersey with the worst job creation numbers said, we must continue to cut government spending to create jobs and prosperity for New Jersey's families. Scott Walker out in Wisconsin vowed to slash and burn. His slash and burn budget lays the foundation to create jobs. And we, the American people, seem to have consumed the big, massive, giant-sized, Kano-sized slash-and-grow Kool-Aid cup full of this ridiculous slash-and-burn mentality. You look at the reality. The steep cuts have cost us jobs. In states that have done this, you have seen an increase in unemployment. The states that didn't slash and burn, the states that actually talked about increasing a little bit of their spending are seeing declining unemployment rates, faster private sector job creation, and stronger job growth. And we're right on the border. We are right near the border. But you look at those states, you know, North Carolina, Michigan, Florida, Nevada, South Carolina, Ohio. You look at those states that are doing this slash and burn stuff, all losing jobs. In fact, what they're saying, a 10% cut equals 1.6% loss in the private employment. So what you're seeing is as we've been saying on this program from the beginning, when you start constricting, when you stop spending money, when you stop providing government services, when you stop employing people, duh, common sense happens, and you have a higher unemployment rate. When you're spiraling down the drain, you're spiraling down the drain, which is exactly what's going on. And anyone who would have bought into this whole idea should have their head examined. But again, it goes back down to this whole mentality that, well, you know, Reagan cut taxes. He cut taxes and the economy grew. That's all I need to know. We cut taxes, the economy grew. The reality is the guy raised taxes 11 times. You never hear that caveat, but you do hear, he cut taxes and we had a great economy. He cut taxes and more revenue came into the government. Yeah, that's because of the 11 tax increases. That's pretty much it. And at the end of the day, if we don't start looking at these budgets and saying, hey, we can't continue this slash and burn, we will be in a, we'll be in a depression. Because we're already headed in that direction. And it's scary, scary times. You know, Jake, I look at this and the reality is, I'm frustrated by the whole thing, but there's not much I can do about it.
Well, I'll tell you what is scary, and I see it almost on a constant basis, almost every day. We talked about Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan, yes, he was very conservative. He was the first real...
Not by today's standards.
Well, yeah, but, I mean, let's be honest, coming out of the 60s and 70s, I mean, it was a real sea change. And it was a reaction of the 60s, and we could spend, you know, hours talking about that. But my point with Reagan was, and is... Yes, he's held up as the icon of the conservatives and no taxes. They abhor taxes. But the difference between Ronald Reagan and these neocons today and these arch conservatives today, Ronald Reagan said, you do not raise taxes unless you have to. And he did. When he had to, he raised taxes. These people today, their mantra is no, never. We will not raise taxes. We will not do it, period. And that is dangerous. That is dangerous when you're talking about running a government. We're not talking about a budget for a family. It's a completely different scenario. But they are willing. They are willing to go down this path. And you watch this lifting of the deficit. Wow. Or of the deficit. You watch the debate on that. You're going to see a bunch of these teabaggers. They're going to hold true. They will put the very economic future of this country at risk for this crazy political philosophy.
Well, and they've taken Governor Grover Norquist's pledge. These again, you know, I don't know anyone, and I would never handcuff myself in any discussion by saying, I'm going to take a 100% ideologically driven pledge. I'm not. There's I can't think of absolutely anything politically that is so sacrosanct that no matter what happens, under any condition, I would never reconsider my position. I just can't imagine going into any leadership position saying, I got blinders on. I don't want to hear nothing. I don't want to see anything. I don't want to talk about it. My way, my preconceived notion, that's the way we need to go. I mean, it's scary stuff. We have got robots running our government, people who are incapable of critical thought. But again, what bothers me is this is what modern education has taught us to be. We're not critical thinkers anymore. We're not problem solvers. We're ideologues. And that, folks, that's what made this country great, the ability to think on our feet, to act, to change directions, to be nimble. This scary, scary stuff, man. Scary, scary stuff. And this whole idea that, I mean, really, from a common sense perspective, stop and think about this whole mentality that if we cut spending, we're going to create jobs. If we take money out of the economy, that's going to create jobs. If we cut taxes for the very wealthy and cut social services for the poor and the downtrodden, that's going to create jobs. And the reality is, and I think Nancy Pelosi finally got it right, tax cuts created our deficit, not jobs. Tax cuts put us in the position we're in. You know, when I talk to people, you know, we've been trained like Pavlovian dogs. To any time we hear the word tax, we salivate. So when you say, well, we need to raise some revenue, we need to raise some taxes, without asking any question, we just begin to foam at the mouth. And our ears somehow must clog. It must be a whole process where, you know, we got the saliva pouring out of our mouth, our eyes kind of glaze over, and our ears fill with who knows what. So we can't see anything, we can't hear anything, and we sure can't say anything because we're just foaming at the mouth. Instead of going, well, what taxes are we talking about increasing? Where is it targeted? How much? What's it going to do? What's it for? Instead of having rational questions, we just kind of plug our ears and just yell inaudibly. But finally, someone who said it, look, it produced our deficit. All of these handouts to the very wealthy produced our deficit. These 103,000 people who control investable money of about $15 trillion, just money laying around in between the seat cushions, in their back pocket, whatever. We gave that to them. And I know someone's sitting out there going, you're talking about redistribution of wealth. Yeah, I am. How do you think they got? How do you think they got $30 million just to roll around in their pocket? Changes in the tax code, redistribution of wealth away from the middle class, the people who could created it, to the people who invested in it. So the difference is, and again, it comes back down to which side are you on? Are you on the side of capital? Or are you on the side of labor? I mean, that's where, when you boil it down to the lowest common denominator, it's, are you on the side of money and capital and corporate power, or are you on the side of workers, on the side of labor, on the side of people who get their hands dirty or punch a clock? That's the question. There's no in between. And what they've done, a masterful job, and you got to give them credit, they have done a masterful job, masterful, of creating a situation where you got a truck driver going, well, you know, I got money in the stock market. I got 3 shares of Ford. I got 2 shares of GE. I'm a stockholder. They don't care about you. But they've done a great job of moving away from a defined retirement plan into 401k. And where's all your money? Wall Street. So you're starting, and I got friends who do this every day. They wake up and they check the stock. Let's see how my pension fund's doing. And I'm not against it. Go ahead. If it gets you through the day, God bless you. But they've created a working class that now identifies with the investor class. Somehow, guy making $30,000, $40,000 a year, now you got a couple of shares. I got some 401k. I'm right up there with the Gateses and the Buffetts. It's amazing stuff. right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. California Governor Jerry Brown has two more days to decide if he'll sign into law a bill that would give farm workers the right to unionize. After making it through the legislature, the bill landed on the governor's desk June 16th, and there it has sat. This weekend, workers, politicians, labor leaders, and celebrities marched to the governor's office in Los Angeles to call for a signature on the bill. An additional contingent of supporters marched on the state capitol building in Sacramento. If ratified, the legislation would streamline the process for farm workers to unionize and provide greater protections from intimidation. Proponents of the legislation say it's necessary to ensure that laws currently on the books are enforced, as it'll provide farm workers with an amplified voice when it comes to basic necessities in the field, such as shade, water, and training, to prevent heat stroke. It will give workers a voice for when dangerous pesticides are being used above suggested limits in the fields, giving consumers a new line of defense before a product comes to market. It will additionally add a way for workers to report discrimination and sexual harassment without risking retribution. At the last minute, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker changed the location of his budget bill signing. Doug Cunningham reports.
Walker had picked the anti-union Badger Sheet Metal Works to sign his anti-union budget bill, but then something happened Friday that apparently shamed even the shameless Walker. News surfaced that the owner of that business, Greg DeCaster, served prison time in a federal tax evasion case. Walker changed the location of his budget signing on that news, but I asked David Goodspeed of Sheet Metal Workers Local 565 about Walker's choice of an anti-union business for his budget signing in the first place.
It's a symbolic measure on their part. They're going to continue poking at union people and trying to undermine the standard of living that union people have in this state. Hopefully the recalls can make a dent in their ability to influence legislation here in the state.
Primaries in the Wisconsin State Senate recalls will be held July 12th, with a regular recall election to follow August 9th. Recall action against Governor Walker can't happen until he's served in office a year, but an effort against him is coming in January. Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You know, again, you know, I saw a piece today that, I forget what the guy's name was. It's not really important. One of these investment guys who said retirement is dead. Retirement, as we know, is now dead because, you know, wages have stagnated. Individual wealth has plummeted. The wealthy are doing very well. The working class doing much worse. Home values have plummeted back 10 years. Your investments, your 401ks, all that stuff back years. Everything has moved backwards for the working class. Now remember and I go back to when I first started a job that I worked at for 18 years before I started this business. The employer said, you know, when you retire in 30 years from this company, you're going to have $1 million. I said, really? $1 million? 30 years? Huh. Wow, that's pretty amazing. You're going to let some dumb truck driver have $1 million. I looked at him and said, never going to happen. The powers to be are never going to allow a dumb truck driver to have $1 million unless a loaf of bread is $500,000. It's never going to happen. not going to happen in my lifetime. And I looked at, after 18 years, I had about $175,000 in my 401k. And got to be honest with you, the next 12 years are not going to reap that kind of massive benefit to where I would have gotten to $1 million. Never going to happen. But that's what they sold us. That's the bill of goods. You just keep putting money into Wall Street. Keep taking your hard-earned dollars, throw it into Wall Street. And you're responsible for it. I mean, that's the greatest scam of all. Instead of saying, you know what, we're gonna make these companies who are invincible. They'd live forever. We give them massive tax breaks. We give them all of this stuff to stay in business. Instead of having them have your pension and make ensure that and do all those things, now we're going to put it on the back of the individual because it's good messaging. We get them to think like investors. And then we start preaching smaller government, smaller, less intrusive government. And what they're really saying is ineffective government, government that's not going to be able to stand in the way of the large corporate entities and protect the individual from the corporate form. So when Wall Street steals half of your wealth and puts it into their pockets, there's no one there really to stop them, and there's no one there to punish them. So we have small, ineffective government. And then as these things continue to happen, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. We put people in charge of government who don't believe in it, who think it's ineffective, believe it should be small and worthless. Now when things go wrong, they say, look, we told you. Granted, we did it, but we told you. So as you move down all of these discussions, why don't we have in this country a full employment policy? Why don't we go back to full employment policies? Where, as the government, we say we're going to be employer of last resort. No more unemployment. We're going to find you a job. Even if that job's taking care of the person down the street who needs a little extra help to stay in their home. Maybe they need their house painted. Maybe they need their grass cut. Maybe they need something. There's a lot of work that's not being done in this country where we could easily have that kind of a full employment policy. Why don't we have that? Well, because it's good to have that reserved, that unemployed. For a couple reasons. One, it's good to have that because it's a drag down on the wages, keeps wages down because you have an oversupply of labor, which, you know, basic supply and demand says you've got an excess supply, demand, the price that they're going to demand is going to be lower. And by having a pretty good size unemployed class, you can go to your workers and say, look, you don't want to be one of them. Be happy you're not one of those people. And then you'll go, oh, yeah, I'm happy I have a job. How often do we hear this? I'm just happy to have a job. And you're not going to stand up and fight back. They know they've got you. You know, so when I see all of this stuff, the pension stuff, the unemployment stuff, the education stuff, the free trade agreements that they're trying to ram through, do you believe the Colombian free trade agreement does not have a provision for labor rights? Now look, I got to be honest. I was a pretty big fan of President Obama. Still like the guy. Still think he's better than the Republican field. But you know what? I sat and listened to him say things like this.
You can trust me when I say that whenever trade deals we negotiate come to my desk, they are going to be good for American workers. That they'll have powerful labor and environmental protections, and that we will enforce those protections.
The Colombian Free Trade Agreement does not have labor rights in the bill. In the agreement, there are no labor protections. Yet I sat no more than 10 feet away from the man when he said that. And look at this. You know, he's gone on and said a number of things.
I will oppose the Colombia Free Trade Agreement if George Bush is insistent on sending it to Congress, because the violence against unions in Colombia would make a mockery of the very labor protections that we've insisted be included in these kinds of agreements.
And here we are talking about the Colombia Free Trade Agreement. And most of these agreements, these aren't good for American workers. These are harmful to American workers. You can't point to any agreement and say, well, you know, we're a net increase on that job. We got more jobs out of that than we lost. None. And these are going to be the same thing. The question is who benefits from these agreements? Again, it goes back down to the financial markets. We're opening up their markets, their financial markets, and agriculture. And, you know, it's always amazed me. And I'll take some flack from some small farmers, which I'm a huge fan of, the small family farmer, the local community farmer, big fan of that. My problems with agribusiness, my problems with the Monsantos, the Archer Daniel Midlands, the big conglomerates. Not the folks working on the 100-acre farm or the 200-acre farm. I'm talking about the people on the 100,000 or the 200,000-acre farms that hire people at less than minimum wage. Not people who are trying to make a living. So understand that right from the start. And these trade agreements aren't going to open up those markets for the small, local, domestic farmer anyway. It's for the big boys. When NAFTA happened, in came all the corn from agribusiness, destroyed the entire farming community of Mexico. Same thing's going to happen to Korea. Same thing's going to happen to Colombia. But it's not going to help the local farmer. And I've always amazed that we're pushing trade agreements that destroy local economies with minimum wage labor. And the jobs here that pay a good, decent, family-sustaining wage, a good living wage, are the jobs that we export so that we can bring those cheap products back to buy with an agricultural salary. That has always amazed me. But yet we seem to, again, especially on the Republican side, to have this this belief in this mythical free trade that has never worked. The only time trade works is when it's mutually beneficial. And we're seeing it. We're seeing the loss of working class wealth. We're seeing the loss of buying power. And it's frustrating, Jake. And on so many levels, we have people who seem not to be at the table thinking of this country first.
Let me ask you something. I mean, there's been rumors the last maybe 6 months with the economy kind of remaining stagnant. Do you think this is a, for lack of a better word, a gift to business to garner their support and perhaps them loosen the strings and unleash some money into the economy, or am I being naive?
I think you're being I think you're naive on this. And if the president is, if that is in the president's calculus, he deserves to lose next November, because these businesses are not going to, they're not going to open up those purse strings because of this. They're not going to open up these their purse strings because he's put all these people on his jobs commission, like Jeffrey Imalt, one of the biggest outsourcers of jobs. Pandering to these folks, I don't think it's going to help him. They're going to get some money. He's going to get some money from Wall Street. He's going to get some money from folks that he's helped. But at the end of the day, the big business community knows which side of the bread their toast's buttered on. And that's on the Republican side.
Well, all the times that the Democrats and labor fought this agreement off, and the big business people have been very aggressive. They come back time and time and time again. He has to know that he's going to take a lot of heat for this. He's going to have to know that.
Well, of course he's going to take heat for it. But at the end of the day, I don't know that he thinks this is a bad idea, that he's been told that this is going to create jobs, and he's doing anything he can possibly do to create jobs. I just don't think it's going to happen. I just don't, and it's scary, scary stuff. But again, you know, we're going to see. And what interests me, I want to see where all those Tea Party people come down. I want to see which side of the equation they come down on this. Because at the end of the day, the majority of them, while they push out this Tea Party mantra, most of them are free traders. They're business people who have been indoctrinated with this free trade idea, that it's possible to have complete open markets with countries like China and India and Colombia and Panama and Korea. It's possible. I'm telling you, it's not. We can have the highest productivity rates in the country, in the globe, and we do, and still not be able to compete. So anyway, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. What are your thoughts on the Colombia Free Trade Agreement? Do we need more coffee and cocaine, or do we need jobs? Right back after this.
America. Rick Smith.
17th century playwright William Congreve must have been a seer, for he wrote that even in hell there is no fury like a woman scorned. Apparently, he foresaw the tempest now roaring out of the League of Women Voters. Long considered to be the church ladies of American politics, the group is best known for its sober voter education efforts. But, pow! The ladies have suddenly shattered that stereotype by delivering a powerful political punch to a couple of U.S. senators, making clear to a startled Washington that they are not to be trifled with. LWV recently ran some hard-hitting TV ads taking Massachusetts Republican Scott Brown and Missouri Democrat Claire McCaskill to task for trying to weaken enforcement of clean air laws. "I was shocked," cried McCaskill. "To me, they have always been about civic engagement and debates." Well, hello, Senator. You've just been civically engaged by a group of feisty women who realized that their polite and earnest letter-writing efforts to lawmakers like you were not working. With both parties kowtowing to the money of corporate polluters, senators were simply ignoring the letters. So the group toughened up. Senator Brown whined that LWV's ad was an ambush, as though the little ladies should stick to their inoffensive knitting. Pathetically, he tried to retaliate with an impetuous video slapping at the women's credibility, whimpering that they, quote, have gone to the gutter with their negative ads. Get a grip, Scott. You voted to gut EPA's Clean Air Authority, so it's hardly gutter politics for a group of mothers and grandmothers to point that out to voters. You've also taken campaign cash from the lobbyists with whom you voted, so it's your credibility that's in question. This is Jim Hightower saying, how shocking that senators are shocked when they're called to account by fed-up voters like the League of Women Voters. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425. Just when he thought it was safe, those crazy Republicans are at it again. It's time for the Rick Smith Show's Conservative Alerts.
Well, you know, Wisconsin, again, in the news, I would think if I lived in Wisconsin, I'd want to move with all the news lately, since the Republicans took over there. And you look at this whole, every time you turn around, something crazier than the last thing. And this thing with the Supreme Court Justice, this David Prosser, the guy who, first he lost the election, and then, oh, hey, by the way, we found 14,000 votes in a computer, one of the poll workers just happened to find. It was one of those things, she was searching for porn, and, oh, hey, Prosser. Prosser, porn, right close to each other, of course, 14,000 votes. He's now put back into the state Supreme Court. Turns out, over the weekend, I guess, or on June 13th, the report broke over the weekend, he had, I guess, grabbed one of the other justices by the throat. I guess they were having some heated disagreement in her office. She told him to gather the sheep and get the flock out. And he somehow ended up with his hands around her neck, according to reports. Now, the people won't say who they are who are in the room, condition of anonymity, because we got to work with these people. Oh, we don't want to step on any toes. Because after all, we've got to work here. Anyway, he was on with Greta Van Susteren, which I think is, why a sitting state Supreme Court justice would go on TV beyond me. But he said, no, he didn't do it. Originally said, no, didn't do it. Absolutely didn't. But later he came around and said, we were having an argument. And she was going, some of the reports are she was coming after him. He was defending himself. So he's saying, I didn't do it. Some of the other people in the room saying, hey, well, the other woman was coming at him. He was maybe defending himself. At the end of the day, he had his hands around her neck. That seems to be the general consensus of the people who were in the room, who are unnamed, of course. But Greta Van Susteren, the Fox News, and again, leave it to Fox News to come up with something that completely off the wall. So now understand, Prosser, the Republican state Supreme Court justice, has his hands around a fellow justice, Ann Walsh Bradley, has his hand around her neck. Greta says that Chief Justice Shirley Abramson, she should resign. She should step down. She said, quote, I don't know. I do know one thing, she says. Chief Justice Shirley Abramson sure is not doing her job to lead the court and to give confidence to the people of Wisconsin. She needs to step aside and let someone else attempt to run that zoo. I'm sorry. The guy had his hands around her neck. Part of me goes, sorry, but, you know, the guy's got her hands around her neck. The Dane County Sheriff's Department is investigating. There are several agencies, you know, looking into this. So it would be interesting to see the sitting Supreme Court justice behind bars.
Well, let's say that he's a judge guilty. Does that other judge have a, is there a system within the Constitution of Wisconsin which allows charges to be brought up against, you understand, a censure, I guess, is, can you censure a Supreme Court judge?
I would assume these would be criminal charges.
Well, I understand that, but let's say that he avoids that.
That I don't know.
Does she have the option? That's a good question. I never thought. I've never heard of a situation.
It wouldn't be her option anyway. It would be like an ethics committee or something that does that. But at the end of the day, if he had her hand had his hands around her neck, that's a criminal offense. He should be found guilty of something.
And that ethics committee would be within the legislature, or would it be a oh God, that God forbid, appointed by the governor?
The governor would decide.
The governor
had him on the back. Attaboy.
Fair and impartial.
He'd give him an attaboy. Some interesting news out of the U.S. Supreme Court. Again, you know, you got to love these 5-4 decisions. In fact, I just say the other 8 should just go home, and we'll just let Anthony Kennedy decide. Sounds reasonable to me. But today they struck down a law that triggers public funding of elections in Arizona. Now, here's the thing. Now, in Arizona, I guess the rule that they had come up with is if someone's being so heavily outspent with private funds, there's a mechanism that kicks in some funds to the other side. So you have at least something of a discussion. Now, understand, since the Citizens United case, corporations now have unlimited access to spending money. They can run whoever they want. They can back whatever candidate they want with as much money as they want. You know, just flood them with money. Because corporations now are people. And they have free speech. And evidently dollars are votes in the mind of our Supreme Court. So what this was going to do is saying, okay, well, we're gonna have some kind of a mechanism to kind of hold that in check. To where, you know, if Walmart wants to run the Walmart candidate, or Target wants to run the Target candidate, or GE, or whoever wants to run their candidate to get their agenda passed through, you know, the public has an interest in that. So we're going to have to throw some money to the other candidate to kind of balance it out so both can get their message out. Seems fairly reasonable. U.S. Supreme Court says no. 5-4 decision. And again, right down the lines. You had the 5 conservatives, the 4, moderate, the liberals, voting against it. And what I find really scary about this is this kind of puts it into the court that we're never going to see publicly funded elections. This is going to be one of those cases that they cite for some time saying, you know what, no, can't have publicly funded elections. Sorry, because you're infringing on free speech. You're infringing on the corporate free speech. Because dollars are votes now. That's the will of the people. Dollars are the will of the people. Doesn't that scare you? Which, again, you know, all the things I talk about Obama, all the things that upset me, the trade agreement, all the things he's done with Wall Street, he's still worlds ahead of where John McCain would be, worlds and worlds ahead of where K. Sarah Palin would be, and any one of the Tea Party Queen and the 7 Dwarfs, he completely outclasses. So here we are in a position where this is our guy. We're going to have to start pushing him in the right direction, and hopefully that happens as we move toward election time and we play some more influence in that. For me, it's going to be who appoints the next Supreme Court justice and the next president. And the right understands this. The radical right really understands that the next president, conceivably, in that 4 years from 13 to 17, could appoint 4 Supreme Court justices. Stop and think of the power. And the right, they're going to spend as much money as they need because they understand. Kennedy's up there in age. Ginsburg's way up there in age. Breyer's way up there in age. Scalia's getting up there. Thomas, no spring chicken, but I don't think he's going anytime soon. So you're looking at the possibility of 4 Supreme Court justices in that next 4-year term. And if you put another 4 John Roberts on the court, we are full-fledged. We are a fascist nation. We are a corporatocracy. No question about it. Another decision out of the Supreme Court, one I actually agree with. It was a 7-2 decision with one on the left, one on the right. It was Thomas and Breyer who dissented. This idea that we can make a law banning the sale of violent video games to minors. That's what the parents are for, I believe, at the end of this. Again, this is one of those personal choice things. I do believe in the First Amendment. I do believe that you need to have, you can't have laws that censor. There's part of me that full head of steam with that. I don't want books. I don't want movies. I don't want things censored. So, again, this kind of falls into that. But there are some compelling arguments in favor of it. Do I want my 8-9-year-old seeing some of the graphic, gruesome, deadly images that these video games put out? Absolutely not. And I will do everything I can do to control that. But at the end of the day, I'm still on the side of free speech and expression. Also, a federal judge, talking about the courts, has blocked the Georgia immigration law. The judge there in Atlanta. Now, this is that immigration law that Georgia passed that is basically, I guess, is going to force taxi drivers to check the immigration status of their passengers. So good luck on that. And reportedly, the bill is killing the farmers in Georgia. Because the farmers can't get anybody. All of the immigrant labor has fled the state. And you've got crops that are now rotting. And this is the part of this whole discussion that nobody wants to talk about. That these immigrants do the hard work at no wages that most of us won't do. And now, look, you're paying $20 an hour to pick lettuce or pick something. You're going to find people who are going to do it. They're not paying 20 bucks an hour. They're not paying health care benefits. They're not paying workman's comp. They're not paying unemployment insurance. They're not paying any of that stuff. They're paying a couple bucks under the table. Here, go out and pick this by the bushel. So the food that we get at the grocery store, it's semi-cheap for a reason. I look at this bill. I can't wait for Nikki Haley to go to Atlanta, step in that cab, and someone to go, Nikki, honey, let me see your papers. You look like a foreigner. You look like a foreigner. Let me see those papers, honey.
It makes no sense, Rick. I mean, these laws are obviously passed by the conservatives down there, but yet the conservatives are for less government. But here you have the government telling the taxi drivers, you've got to ask them, do they really have citizenship here?
And
that's
crazy.
How many
drivers have papers?
Have you been to New York? I don't know. Do you really want to go there?
Have you been to New York?
Wait a minute, Rick. If you want to be honest, I've been to quite a few cities where a lot of the taxi drivers were, they may or may not have been naturalized citizens. Washington, D.C., exactly.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. When we come back, we're going to talk with Scott Cooper, president-elect of the Pennsylvania Association for Justice. We're right back after this.
Show, changing America for the better.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make regulation happen!
With a PSECU Home Equity line of credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got a rate so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer's a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing light is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pseccu.com/life.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
So the so-called Fair Share Act was passed today by the Pennsylvania State House. Another right-wing euphemism for let's screw the individual and score more points with our corporate overlords. And again, you know, you look at this and you go, which side are you on? On the radical right, you've got House Majority Leader Mike Turdzai, the Republican, saying that this bill is about, it's about people. It's about communities. It's about employers and families sustaining jobs. So it's a jobs bill. Stealing rights away from people, it's a jobs bill. House Minority Leader Frank Dermody said what this is just part of a right-wing agenda attacking the middle class. We reward the wealthiest corporations. We punish the innocent victims. It's not right. This should not pass. This House, we should all be about protecting the people's rights, not taking them away. So again, you know, it depends how you look at this. Going back to what we were talking about earlier, capital or labor? Big business or workers? You decide. That's why I've asked Scott Cooper to come on the program. He is the president-elect of the Pennsylvania Association for Justice to come talk about this. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks, Rick.
You know, I look at this and it's gone by a couple of names, joint and several, liability, fair share, you know, anything but fair, I think, here.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head, actually better than any lawyer could. You know, I think this is basically, it's not a Fair Share Act. It's not, I think Frank Dermody said it best. It's more like a Wrongdoer Protection Act, or it's more like corporate welfare that has absolutely nothing to do with creating jobs, but basically it's almost like giving a get out of jail free card to bad businesses.
Well, run me through this because, you know, I've talked to a number of people about this, and it's very difficult to message around this. Other than the fact of the matter is if you're injured in this state now and someone goes out of business, files bankruptcy, whatever, you now, the injured person, pretty well screwed as I'm getting it.
Under the new law, yes. The way the law is now, it is more fair and it protects the injured victim one way or the other, that the victim is not going to be left holding the bag. Under the new law, as it's going to be effective immediately as soon as the governor signs it, you have a situation where, let's say, someone goes in the Lowe's and buys a table saw, and it turns out it's manufactured in China, and they end up cutting their fingers off. And it turns out that the Chinese manufacturer manufactured a shoddy product. Lowe's knew about it, and then you go to the lawyer, and the lawyer can only sue Lowe's because you can never get jurisdiction over a Chinese manufacturer anyway. You can't get them into Pennsylvania court. You can't get them into a state court. Under the new law, chances are a jury would apportion Lowe's and the Chinese manufacturer 50-50. Under the new law, the injured victim's only going to recover 50% of their damages, whereas under the old law, the victim is guaranteed at least getting their 100% damages, and then let Lowe's go and try and get what's called contribution, money paid back from the Chinese manufacturer. And, you know, the winners in these cases are the big companies, the foreign corporations, the Marcellus Shale people, the insurance companies. And under this new law, the losers are really going to end up being the taxpayers, the unions, the insurance consumers, the people injured, the children of people injured, and there's not going to be any job created or any insurance premium saved. There's nothing in the law that says that.
Well, how are the taxpayers going to be held liable for this?
Well, ultimately what happens is because it just follows through that when a person right now is injured and they're compensated, if they're going to receive up to 100% compensation, they don't end up the state gets paid back any claims that they paid for medical bills. Also, the person gets fully compensated to what they've already been determined by a jury to be compensated. Under this new law, a person is clearly not going to be compensated 100%. And then what happens is they're going to have to apply for medical assistance or Medicare or other state funds, which is funded by taxpaying dollars.
You know, I was listening to some of the discussion, and one of the guys was talking about this bill is going to be a defense of the defendants. This is going to help the defendants. And I wished someone would have jumped up and said, well, what about the victims? Because I think he's right. I think at the end of this, we have done a masterful job of protecting the defendants in this, which are the folks who may have caused or are responsible for any injury, yet the victims, the people who, through no fault of their own, they're the ones who were harmed in this.
And that I think is the one thing which, you know, I hate to use the word cowards or something, but Mike Terzai stands up and says, well, this is to protect businesses, and he hides behind talking points and doesn't admit that, you know, this is going to hurt injured victims and that people will not be fully compensated and that people in these Senate hearings would never admit that they would want the same protections that the injured victims would want. That this is all a, you know, big, you know, business grab in order to basically give them, you know, a lack of accountability and be able to, you know, create shell corporations and screw the injured person.
So basically we're protecting insurance companies and big businesses at the expense of the little guy, which is, hey, that is the Republican mantra. And what I've been hearing, again, time and time again from our friends on the right, is this is tort reform. And they use that word reform like it's, well, somehow it's good. We've reformed the system. It's wonderful. But for who?
Well, and I think the other thing is this just shows almost that on the right with a lot of the Republicans, not all, maybe 99% of them, but that they're supposedly against big government and they want less regulation, but this is no more than big government getting involved in people's personal lives and the courts. And what they want to do now, not only do they want to pass, they're going to pass this, but what they want to do is basically create almost, if they could have immunity for every corporation, every bad actor, anyone who makes an unsafe product, that's what they want to do. They want to have no oversight, no accountability, and basically let corporations run over the injured person.
Well, corporations will police themselves, Scott. Come on, they're afraid of you. They're afraid of people like you, you trial lawyers. They're going to police themselves because they don't want to get sued. They're responsible business owners.
Right, they did a great job with the Wall Street, you know, creating that whole havoc. And I agree with you. I think the problem is That's what the that's what the corporations and the insurance companies are worried about, is that it's through lawsuits that products have been made safer. Insurance companies have been held accountable for bad faith and when they act recklessly and unreasonable in denying life insurance claims or insurance claims. And if, you know, Mike Terzai and Kurt Schroeder and Jay Corman and Governor Corbett, want to, you know, they want to give these corporations absolute immunity.
Because after all, they create jobs, right? So I guess if you run this all full circle and you use the Tea Party, that linguistic machine that they've got, that translator that helps them turn logic into Tea Party, this bill will create jobs.
And we know it won't, but they say it will. And, I think they should just be honest. And if we sit back and we talk a year from now, I'd be willing to bet you a dinner that one job will not come to this state from this law.
But I'll guarantee you there are going to be some people out there who are injured who are going to be on the backs of the taxpayer. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Attorney Scott Cooper. He's president-elect of the Pennsylvania Association for Justice. In looking at this, is there any chance the governor's going to sign it? He ran on it. This is part of his reform package. Any chance of going back once this governor and once these Tea Party types are gone? Any history that will give us an idea of where we go from here?
As far as legislation or as far as attacking
the joint and several, the quote unquote for fair share. Is there any chance of overturning this down the road? What's the push from here?
Well, we've already beat it down twice. You know, once on the constitutional challenge when Mike Terzai tried to basically illegally pass it through violating the Constitution, and then Governor Rendell vetoed it. He did say he'd sign a fair bill, but this was not fair. And so now this would be the third time, and there are certain potential constitutional violations in the bill. That people are going to challenge. For instance, I would think that the 60% threshold potentially has, under the state constitution, an equal protection violation, because there's been, under the law, you're supposed to give a rational basis for coming up with the number, and no one's ever produced a rational basis. Also, our state constitution does not allow the legislature to restrict people's rights to recover. You can't cap damages, and there's a very good argument to be made that a lot of people brighter than, smarter than me in this area have said it violates our state constitution. So hopefully third time's a charm.
Well, I think they had a rational basis for coming up with the 60% number. They reached around back to their backside, and they popped it out like they do with most facts.
Well, that's generally what they try to do. And, quite honestly, I'd love to have a chance to have an open, question and answer with either Mike Terzai or Kurt Schroeder when they can't hide behind the talking points. And I testified in the House Judiciary Committee hearing, and I actually asked a question to Kurt Schroeder, who was asking me a question, and I was basically scolded and told, and it's even in the record, you don't ask questions, only we ask questions.
And that is the response that you'll get to any request for discussion with those folks.
And the one thing I think, if the general public looks at this, and I think the one thing the business people were scared of, and, if they were honest with everyone, they would admit it, if this whole issue was a jury trial where you look at the facts and you see what is really happening, we'd win this. And that's the problem, is that people are – the business people are deceiving the public. And, yes, they have the votes. They have the governorship, the House, and the Senate. So, it's not a fair game to begin with.
Yeah. And, again, as I'm telling people on all of this radical agenda that's going on, all of this stuff, look back and say, who did this? This is not – they don't need a Democrat in the room to do any of this stuff. They can railroad this stuff through. They can steamroll through whatever they want.
Right, and the only thing they can't do, and now they're having a problem, is with the budget, because on certain bills they need 2/3, and now all of a sudden they want the Democrats to try to help them. But, this is just the first step. You see what they're doing. They're trying to break the unions, the teachers, Next, they're, you know, this is just, it happened, it's happening all over in Wisconsin, and, you know, hopefully this will, you know, people will realize once they end up in a situation where joint and several liability cannot no longer help them, that, you know, no one's, that we're doing the best we can, but these guys, you know, Terzai and Schroeder and, I hope it's one term Tom, are not helping them.
Yeah. Again, this is a big sloppy wet kiss to the business, to the big business community. It's exactly what it is.
Well, what is it? If you put, you can't put lipstick on a pig, and I forgot the quote or something like that.
Yeah, right along that. I mean, this is it's the business wet dream. This whole administration. Scott Cooper, I appreciate the time. Thanks for the information. I got to tell you, I'm not happy.
Well, neither am I. But you know, we'll keep fighting. And thanks for having me. And hopefully, we'll talk again.
Anytime. Love to have you back. Scott Cooper, President-elect of the Pennsylvania Association for Justice. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Joanna, and my job is to protect children, to help them live in safe and stable families. I work for you, the taxpayers in Children and Youth Services. Every day, I help children and families in crisis. Many parents have lost their jobs, making it harder to keep a roof overhead, food on the table, and stress under control. My caseloads are huge, and waiting lists for critical services are too long. Yet I know the safety of these children depends on me. Even in tough economic times, legislators must fund these vital programs. Because if we don't help these kids now, the cost to them and to us will be much higher later on. Children don't only depend on me doing my job, they're counting on you to care about their safety. Contact your state legislators today. Demand that they invest in programs that prevent and treat child abuse. Because a child in pain shouldn't have to wait.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our Human Services campaign.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
That old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
My name is Michelle Bachman. I stand here in the midst of many friends and many family members to announce formally my candidacy for President of the United States.
Yay. Yay. Yeah, that was the most subdued yay I think I've ever heard. Yay. At this point, all she's really got is believing. Because, you know, I look at this screw up, and again, you know, open mouth, insert foot. I tell you, I think it's funny. You know, the reality is, you go, well, you know, I want to be like, you know, I want to be like.
Well, what I want them to know is, just like John Wayne was from Waterloo, Iowa, that's just the kind of spirit that I have, too.
Yeah. Got the spirit of John Wayne in me. Yes, got the spirit of John Wayne. Actually, John Wayne was from Winterset, Iowa, which was a couple hundred miles away. But John Wayne Gacy was from Waterloo, Iowa. So she's got the spirit of John Wayne Gacy in her. And again, you know, hey, two-thirds right for a Republican, That's pretty good odds right there. You know, she's two-thirds right. She was two-thirds of the way there. You know, and I, you know, if, here's the thing. If Sarah Palin were telling the story, you know, it would be John Wayne riding on a horse firing warning shots, you know, in Boston or in Chicago to warn the British were coming. You know.
I'd like to know who her staff keeps feeding her wrong information.
I'll tell you, he's fired. But she announced her bid today in Iowa. Evidently, the New Hampshire announcement is coming soon, and then probably South Carolina. She'll announce again she's running for president. I'm sure Pennsylvania's down the road at some point, but she may announce again. I guess she needs to keep saying it now. I guess this is the second time she has announced it. So good for her. But understand, and, you know, we make fun of her, and trust me, from now until the election where she wises up and gives up, you're going to see clown makeup everywhere. There's a resurgence in sales in those big red bulbous noses. You know, clown feet and hair and all the makeup, that is absolutely going to be in vogue, and you're going to see at least one person everywhere she goes. I really believe this. Everywhere she goes, there's going to be a clown waiting for her. The ghost of John Wayne Gacy.
Well, I hate to tell you this, maybe. I just saw a poll tonight.
She's the leader.
Not the poll I saw, but she's very close to Romney.
A couple of them. One, again, the polls are like...
You know what people like about her? You can think she's crazy. Some of us might think she's, you know, on the edge of maybe being a little bit nuts. But she's sincere. She's a sincere crazy. And some people
crazy.
Like that.
You're right. She's sincerely crazy. Okay, I'll go there with you.
I mean,
one of the things that she has been is a critic of these of something called earmarks. And in fact, to her, she says they're part of the root problem in Washington spending addiction. The only problem is that, you know, she's had her fixes every now and again, and taken her share of government handouts. Now, there's a counseling clinic in Minnesota that for the last couple of years has gotten $30,000 from the state of Minnesota. Some of that money came from the federal government, earmarked. Who was that clinic run by? Oh, yeah, her husband. There's a family farm in Wisconsin that received some $260,000 in federal farm subsidies. Whose farm is that? Oh, yeah, it's her family's farm. And she argues, just like she did recently, that that transportation projects, well, that shouldn't be considered pork. We shouldn't consider those transportation projects anything but necessities. You know, like the bridge to nowhere. Got to have a bridge going nowhere. And, you know, I got to be honest, I think massive hypocrisy. You know, she runs around saying Obamacare is socialized medicine, yet her husband applied for and received, like I said, $30,000 in public money for his counseling clinic. And, of course, you know, the clinic, it aims to provide good quality Christian counseling in a sensitive, loving environment. That's according to his website. But, you know, hey, I guess if you can look yourself in the mirror and say, you know what, we're doing some good Christian work, maybe hypocrisy's not that bad.
She's in a district that's very safe.
Of course she is.
Heavily Republican.
Of course she is. But here's the reality. Her family-owned farm that her late father-in-law left received $260,000 in federal funds. Over a quarter of $1 million. Corn and dairy subsidies. And she got some of that. And it's in her financial disclosures. Got to give her credit. She was at least honest on her financial disclosures. Taking somewhere between $32,000 and $105,000. Now, she has been someone who has been completely opposed to farm programs. All of those federal farm programs she's been completely against, but that doesn't mean she's not going to take it. And again, she was against completely against the stimulus package, completely against it. But yet, she benefited from it. So you got to kind of look at this because, you know, the USDA bought a whole bunch of pork and a whole bunch of dairy products from USDA programs to put better food into school. The stimulus package built, she wanted money to build roads. She's all over the map there. And her philosophy, I guess, is, well, you know, if we're going to do it, I might as well get some of it. But that doesn't change the culture. And look, you know, I'm not against some of the things she went after. She went after some rail projects. She went after some highway projects. Some of the things she went after were not bad things. Things I would expect any congressperson to do. But she has this rhetoric that she has to keep throwing out there. And she has said a whole lot of crazy things over the years. One of my favorites of all time is that if we abolish the minimum wage, we're going to create jobs. You know, so we just get away from that minimum wage, we'll create millions of jobs. There'll be no more unemployed because they can work for 50 cents an hour if we want.
Sadly, there's some truth in that. You probably would create jobs. But who wants to work for a dollar an hour?
I don't think you would. I really don't think you would.
Really?
Because you wouldn't have consumers. Who's going to buy the products if no one has any money? Another one of my favorites is, you know, Bachman warned that the Lion King was gay. It's just gay propaganda. It's just gay propaganda because, you know, the school teacher is going to hold up a picture of the Lion King and say, you know what? The music was written by a gay guy. And the gay guy's better than you, so it's okay to be gay. Again, you know, just kind of, really? Does a second grade teacher do that? No. One of my other favorites is that she said that, you know, they're scientists. Nobel winning prizers. They're into intelligent design. Hundreds of them. Hundreds. There's not. Sorry. Another one of my favorites, you know, like Rick Santorum, who ran down to Florida when Terri Schiavo was, when that whole fiasco was going on. Bachman said she was healthy. She was healthy. Yeah, don't worry. She was healthy. Sure, she had a little brain damage, sure. But she was healthy. You know, not that those machines were keeping her alive or anything, but another one of my favorites. Carbon dioxide is harmless. Carbon dioxide is harmless. It's harmless. You know, you could sit in your garage with your car running for days and days. Completely harmless. Michelle, try it. Oh.
Maybe she did, Rick. Did you ever think of that?
Maybe so. But again, you know, a lot of this stuff, time and time again, it's just plain crazy. Like she said that visiting Iraq was like going to the Mall of America. Same thing. Don't worry about it. There's a commonality with the Mall of America, she said. And in that, it's the proportion. You know, it's a proportion. There was marble everywhere. The other thing is, I remarked, was there was water everywhere. Yeah, you do know we were at war at that time, and still are. Okay, just as long as you know. She's just all over the place, just nuts. And my favorite, my all-time favorite, Glenn Beck could solve the debt crisis. I think if we give Glenn Beck the numbers, he can solve this nation's debt problem.
There you go, Secretary of the Treasury. There you go.
And, you know, like I talked about earlier, you know, she's got this thing with Beck, and I'm going, is this really the guy we want to have direct access? Do we want the red phone? You know, it's the Beck phone now. You know, it's like the bat phone. Michelle wakes up at 3 o'clock. Glenn, I'm worried about the federal deficit. What should I do? Let me get my chalkboard out. It's insane. And what's even more insane is I've seen polls that have her as the front runner. I mean, look, I joke about Republicans having an idiot doofus base. I mean, I joke about it. How could she be the front runner? Please. Are we that screwed up? Are we are we that desperate for entertainment? And I think we are. When we come back, we're going to talk with John Logan, professor at San Francisco State University, about the anniversary. Today's the anniversary of the National Labor Relations Act. We're going to talk a little bit about that. Stick around. We're right back after this. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Time to talk.
Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. California Governor Jerry Brown has two more days to decide if he'll sign into law a bill that would give farm workers the right to unionize. After making it through the legislature, the bill landed on the governor's desk June 16th, and there it has sat. This weekend, workers, politicians, labor leaders, and celebrities marched to the governor's office in Los Angeles to call for a signature on the bill. An additional contingent of supporters marched on the state capitol building in Sacramento. If ratified, the legislation would streamline the process for farm workers to unionize and provide greater protections from intimidation. Proponents of the legislation say it's necessary to ensure that laws currently on the books are enforced, as it'll provide farm workers with an amplified voice when it comes to basic necessities in the field, such as shade, water, and training, to prevent heat stroke. It will give workers a voice for when dangerous pesticides are being used above suggested limits in the fields, giving consumers a new line of defense before a product comes to market. It will additionally add a way for workers to report discrimination and sexual harassment without risking retribution. At the last minute, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker changed the location of his budget bill signing. Doug Cunningham reports.
Walker had picked the anti-union Badger Sheet Metal Works to sign his anti-union budget bill, but then something happened Friday that apparently shamed even the shameless Walker. News surfaced that the owner of that business, Greg DeCaster, served prison time in a federal tax evasion case. Walker changed the location of his budget signing on that news, but I asked David Goodspeed of Sheet Metal Workers Local 565 about Walker's choice of an anti-union business for his budget signing in the first place.
It's a symbolic measure on their part. They're going to continue poking at union people and trying to undermine the standard of living that union people have in the state. Hopefully the recalls can make a dent in their ability to influence legislation here in the state.
Primaries in the Wisconsin State Senate recalls will be held July 12th, with a regular recall election to follow August 9th. Recall action against Governor Walker can't happen until he's served in office a year, but an effort against him is coming in January. Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Your proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith. Come on, you good workers, good news.
Well, you know, that's the big question. Which side are you on? You're on the side of capital or you're on the side of labor? That's what it boils down to at the end of the day. And today, back in 1935, Congress evidently was on the side of labor when they passed the National Labor Relations Act. Or, you know, look, at the end of the day, this was some way to cut down on the number of strikes, to bring both parties to the table, creating a structure for collective bargaining in the United States. And, you know, here we are. All these years later, you've got the radical right in virtually every Republican-controlled state attacking this right, and especially in South Carolina, where it has become a hot-button issue over the Boeing situation. That's why I've asked John Logan, a professor at San Francisco State University, to come talk to us about his piece, Boeing, the NLRB, and the GOP. John, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi, very pleased to be on. Thank you.
You know, I'm looking at this today. Today is the anniversary of the passage of the National Labor Relations Act, which, to be honest, in its original form was, in my opinion, beneficial for working people, something that created a massive middle class in this country.
Yeah, and as you said, I mean, what we have now is a very sustained attack on the NLRB, the independent agency that enforces the act, first over the decision to issue a complaint, not even a decision, but the simply the action to issue a complaint over Boeing's possibly illegal action in transferring jobs from Washington State to South Carolina in retaliation for the Washington State workers workers going out on strike, and now more attacks that the NLRB has issued a proposal for a new rule on certification for union recognition elections. It's a very modest rule. It's simply designed to get rid of the very worst cases of delay whereby unscrupulous employers use delaying tactics to undermine employee free choice. And this will simply get rid of the very worst of these cases. It's not setting out 10-day elections, even 20-day elections, but simply try and avoid litigation, to try and improve access to information on election issues. Again, you know, the board is being attacked relentlessly for common sense and issuing a rule that's based on basic fairness.
You know, what I've been saying recently, and the reality is for so long, the NLRB has been used against working people. And I look back to the Kentucky River cases back during the Bush administration.
Yeah.
There weren't very many people attacking the NLRB then, except some workers who had their rights stolen from them.
Sure. But now and it was very clear. I mean, as soon as the Republicans gained control of the House in January, they had been looking for an issue right away. You had a number of hearings that they had called through the House committee on the NLRB and the funding of the board, and they were looking for something, to attack the board, but they hadn't really found the issue. And Boeing really provided them with the issue that they were looking for, and now the new election rule, they're trying to ramp up the attacks. So with Boeing, they were, in addition to attacking the actions in that particular case, I mean, they were certainly trying to sort of create this narrative of an agency that was run amok, that was out of control. And then, everyone was waiting for, expecting that there would be a rule on elections. And, their intention was to say, look, this is just another example of out of control agency that's in the pocket of the unions. And of course, by extension, their argument is that the Obama administration is also in the pocket of the unions, which, of course, the unions would like to be true, but we all know it's very, very far from the truth.
Yeah, I agree. Let me ask you this. In looking at the National Labor Relations Act and the Railway Act, I've seen some on the right saying, what we should do is we should just repeal them now. And I got to be honest, there's a big part of me that says, yeah, go ahead. So we can go back to the days where, like when you had sit-down strikes where people said, we're going to sit down. We're not going to work today. Where airline pilots say, we're not going to go to work today because it's not illegal to say no anymore.
Sure. I think they're right. I mean, as you said, that there's certainly a number on the extreme right. Well, what we used to consider the extreme right, the center has moved so far to the right these days, it's no longer considered extreme. But, who say that, this act no longer serves the purpose. It's time to get rid of the act. It's time to get rid of the board. You've heard a number of the Republican candidates for president saying that the NLRB should be defunded, effectively saying that we ought to get rid of the board. But mainstream employer associations were essentially quite happy with the status quo. I mean, they didn't see any need to get rid of the board or get rid of the act because it was really delivering them what they wanted. I mean, they had a stranglehold over the system of union recognition. And, as long as nothing sort of changed the dynamics of that system, it was serving their purposes very well,
yep,
delivering what they wanted, which was a union-free environment. Now, the reason that they react in such an over-the-top way when you have relatively modest proposals such as this new election rule and then the action in deciding to issue a complaint against Boeing is that clearly anything that strengthens the rights to organize and bargain collectively is a life and death issue for them. They have complete control over the process and they're absolutely not prepared to give it up in any way. And so even though these are very, very minor things, I mean, no one really believes that this new election rule will reverse the catastrophic decline that we've seen in union membership over the past few decades. No one really believes that it will provide union representation for the tens of millions workers who say, and according to every survey, that they want union representation, but they can't get it because of weak legal protection and strong employer opposition. But nonetheless, I mean, there are minor things that you know offer the potential to challenge the complete control they have, the stranglehold they have over the current system, and that's why you see this real over the top reaction that we've had with these two things.
Yeah, and it fits the frame pretty well. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show with John Logan, professor and director of labor studies at San Francisco State University. He's written a great piece, Boeing, the NLRB, and the GOP. You can get to the link on our site at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on John Logan's name. It'll take you right there. The perfect frame that they've set up, and again, for the Tenther folks who push that whole that states' rights stuff, this is the perfect setup for between right-to-work states and non-right-to-work states, even though that, in the Boeing case, shouldn't even be close to the issue, has nothing to do with it. That's the shiny thing that they've put out for the simple-minded to focus on.
Yeah, absolutely. As you say, I mean, they've tried to make this about absolutely anything other than the central issue. I mean, and the central issue clearly is, you know, did Boeing violate the law? I mean, that's really the key question here. But instead, they've tried to make it about, you know, this government agency, these government bureaucrats that are trying to tell a private company that's investing in America. I say investing in America, even though Boeing, which is the recipient of billions of dollars of contracts from the U.S. government, from taxpayers' money, has outsourced tens of thousands of jobs in recent years. But, you know, the story from the right wing is that you hear that you have a private company that's investing in American jobs, and you have these government bureaucrats that are trying to tell it where it can and cannot do business. Not a single job is being created here. These are jobs that are being transferred from Washington to South Carolina, and it certainly appears that the reason that they're being transferred is in retaliation for the Washington workers exercising a right that is protected by law, the right to strike. And the other thing, as you say, is that they've also tried to frame it as an attack on right-to-work states generally, which, again, is no such thing. The legal issues involved in the case would be exactly the same if Boeing had moved the jobs to another part of Washington State or if it had moved the jobs to the moon. The issue is the reason why it transferred those jobs. So, you know, under U.S. law, people who study labor and employment law often like to say that, you know, that the employers have the right to take actions for good reasons, for bad reasons, or for no reason at all, but they don't have the right to take actions for discriminatory reasons, and that's precisely what is happening here.
Absolutely. You brought up an interesting point, though, that this whole zero net gain, the fact that no new jobs are being created, and that's part of the messaging that has to be out there. But the other part of the fact that there are no jobs being created, as a nation, as a middle class, the wealth of the working class is being reduced because the wages, the benefits, all of the things that the workers in Washington State were getting are going to be reduced as you move to South Carolina.
Sure. Absolutely. I mean, that is definitely the case. And, you know, that's probably, you know, part of the motivation behind this. But as I said, you know, the primary motivation, according to what Boeing executives have said themselves, is that they did not want to face another work stoppage. In other words, they were retaliating against the Washington State workers for exercising their right to strike. But there's no reason, there's absolutely no question that the reason that companies locate in states like South Carolina is that they want workers who will work for cheaper wages with less benefits. Who have 401k pension plans and
no job security and no
exactly.
health care benefits
and so if you add up, you know, if you look at the starting wages in Washington State and South Carolina are somewhat similar, but the progression in Washington State means that the workers actually have an opportunity to increase their wages significantly, and also importantly, as you said, they get far better health care and pension benefits. But again, as I said, I mean, we have to keep a clear focus on the central issue here, and that's, you know, why did the company transfer these jobs? And according to the company's own executives, I mean, this is not the machine. machinist union saying it here. This is Boeing's executive vice president saying in a televised interview with the Seattle Times that the principal reason that they moved these jobs, that they located the production in South Carolina, was not because of the business climate. It was not because of the wages that they currently pay. It was because they couldn't afford to have a work stoppage every 3 years. And you know, that's it. On the face of it, that seems like a clear violation of Section 83 of the National Labor Relations Act. You cannot retaliate or interfere with workers for exercising a protected activity.
And that's it in a nutshell. Last question I've got for you. You know, in looking at this and down, this is going to take, a couple of years to work its way through. Let's say at the end of the road they decide on the side of the workers. Here Boeing has constructed a $750 million facility. Is it possible to say, sorry, you're going to have to close that and move those jobs back? Or basically, are they going to get a slap on the wrist?
Right. Well, again, you know, it's very, very common and a very established legal practice that the accepted remedy is a return to the status quo. And so, you know, if Boeing is found guilty of discriminating against these workers, a correct remedy would be that these jobs have to be returned. But I mean, the idea that, you know, Boeing has invested $750 million and that would be money down the drain is clearly nonsense. For one thing, the facility in North Charleston, South Carolina, is way larger than would be necessary to build these three planes a year that are, you know, the disputed work. And so Boeing clearly has other plans for South Carolina and for creating jobs there. As I said before, I mean, it has outsourced many, many jobs in the past. You know, let's bring some of those jobs back to the United States, and put them in South Carolina. If Boeing has sense, and you know, clearly it's really not in anyone's interest to see this carry on for years and years and years, it can easily come to a settlement. The machinist union has already offered a settlement to Boeing, which Boeing rejected, which actually involved keeping the jobs in South Carolina in return for guarantees of other work being located in the Puget Sound area in Everett and Washington. Boeing can certainly settle this dispute without you know, it having to go through the administrative law judge, the NLRB, the, you know, the Court of Appeals.
You know, yeah, but here's the thing. At the end of all of this, I think Boeing's intent, and as you've said, it's a larger facility, is to move that work from Washington to South Carolina eventually down the road anyway. So they're not going to make an agreement to keep that work there and bring in the new work. I just don't see that.
Well, certainly, as you said, I mean, that's the concern that, you know, here we're talking about, you know, a couple of thousand jobs, the final assembly of three of the Dreamliner planes per month. But in the longer term, the concern is that, you know, this is just a thin edge of the wedge and that, you know, Boeing really intends to expand in South Carolina on a large scale and to run down some of the production in the Puget Sound area in retaliation for you know, the workers there wanting to be in a union and to exercise their protected rights. You know, Boeing is likely to be in the Puget Sound area for some time. And you know, this is the somewhat mysterious thing about this whole dispute. I mean, when you look at the size of corporation that Boeing is, as I mentioned before, the number of contracts and very, very large contracts it gets from the government and gets from both Democratic and Republican administrations, it's a bit of a mystery why Boeing would do this. It certainly doesn't clearly seem to be in the sort of immediate self-interest of the company to behave in this way. And, you know, again, while I agree with what you were saying, I think, you know, that one could make a strong argument that it's in the company's best interest to settle this dispute and not Boeing executives have said when asked directly, are they confident that they did not violate the law? I think the response was something along the lines that they're confident that they'll prevail in the court. courts. Now, of course, ultimately that might be the case. You know, I mean, unions can certainly not be confident that, you know, if this thing gets as far as the Court of Appeals or even the Supreme Court, that they would get a sympathetic hearing. But really, you know, I can't see that, you know, it's in either side's interest for this thing to be prolonged for years and to go that far. You know, one hopes that they see sense. On the other hand, as I've written and said before, Boeing might be prepared to settle, but the Republicans who are using this as an excuse to attack the board and to attack the labor rights that the board protects, I mean, they will never settle.
Yep.
There will always be another excuse for them to attack the board.
And it's a good wedge issue, and it keeps the North and the South at each other's throats, and it keeps, you know, union workers and non-union workers at each other's throats. It's a good divisive issue.
Sure. And it's ultimately the right to organize and the right to bargain collectively that they object to. It's nothing to do with this particular dispute.
Yep. Professor John Logan, professor at the San Francisco State University's Director of Labor Studies there, written a good piece, Boeing, the NLRB, and the GOP. We've got a link at our site at therickSmithShow.com. Professor Logan, I appreciate your time. Always great talking with you.
Okay. Very happy to talk.
All right. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
17th century playwright William Congreve must have been a seer, for he wrote that even in hell there is no fury like a woman scorned. Apparently, he foresaw the tempest now roaring out of the League of Women Voters. Long considered to be the church ladies of American politics, the group is best known for its sober voter education efforts. But pow! The ladies have suddenly shattered that stereotype by delivering a powerful political punch to a couple of U.S. senators, making clear to a startled Washington that they are not to be trifled with. LWV recently ran some hard-hitting TV ads taking Massachusetts Republican Scott Brown and Missouri Democrat Claire McCaskill to task for trying to weaken enforcement of clean air laws. "I was shocked," cried McCaskill. "To me, they have always been about civic engagement and debates." Well, hello, Senator. You've just been civically engaged by a group of feisty women who realized that their polite and earnest letter-writing efforts to lawmakers like you were not working. With both parties kowtowing to the money of corporate polluters, senators were simply ignoring the letters. So the group toughened up. Senator Brown whined that LWV's ad was an ambush, as though the little ladies should stick to their inoffensive knitting. Pathetically, he tried to retaliate with an impetuous video slapping at the women's credibility, whimpering that they, quote, have gone to the gutter with their negative ads. Get a grip, Scott. You voted to gut EPA's Clean Air Authority, so it's hardly gutter politics for a group of mothers and grandmothers to point that out to voters. You've also taken campaign cash from the lobbyists with whom you voted, so it's your credibility that's in question. This is Jim Hightower saying, how shocking that senators are shocked when they're called to account by fed-up voters like the League of Women Voters.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
I give my head to the new constitution. Take a bow for the new revolution. Smiley and free with the change all around. Pick up my guitar and play. Just like yesterday. Then I'll get on my knees.
Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Also, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can check out our podcast by downloading it from our website. Soon we will have the Stitcher app up, and that will be a good thing. As if I needed another reason to get out of Iraq and Afghanistan, turns out we have been spending $20.2 billion a year on air conditioning alone for the troops stationed in Afghanistan and Iraq. That's more than the entire budget of NASA. In fact, it's the same amount of money, that same amount of money is the same amount that the G8 has committed to helping Tanzania and Egypt. So we're just sending that simply on air conditioning. Stop and think about that for a bit. Now look, I'm not saying that they don't deserve to be comforted. I'm not saying that they don't deserve to have that there. I'm saying it's another in a long line of really, really huge expenses that we really don't need. We should be bringing those people home. And what frustrates me is you look at the reality is, in June, we have reached 11 deaths, 11 combat deaths. That's the most since May of 2009. Yet our president says, quote, "We take comfort in knowing that the tide of war is receding. Fewer of our sons and daughters are serving in harm's way. We have ended our combat mission in Iraq with 100,000 American troops already out of that country. Yet we have had the deadliest month since May of 2009. You know, and, you know, you look at this, and I keep going back to the fact that, you know, we're still seeing the loss of life. We're still seeing the loss of treasury. And yet, I'm sorry, I'm just not seeing us in all that much better position than we were before. I'm not seeing the media covering what's going on as much. It's not splashed on the front page. Every time a soldier is killed, it's not front page news anymore. And that scares me. It absolutely scares me. And again, you know, we're talking about, you know, in Libya, we're talking about, you know, again, continuing the Bush policy. And Jake, I got to tell you, it's one of those things that's frustrating.
When you talk about Afghanistan, you talk about Iraq. There, what doesn't get enough thrift, what doesn't get enough publicity and exposure is the fact that the number of troops coming back with severe mental and emotional problems and the number of troops that have committed suicide, it doesn't appear that those numbers are going down, because it's a lot of these men who served in combat saw some of their friends and their comrades killed, are going to have deep psychological problems, some of them for the rest of their life, and that's another price that we pay as a nation for war.
$20.2 billion on air conditioning. $20.2 billion. And if you remember at the beginning, we couldn't get them flak jackets. We couldn't get them
the Humvees.
Armor on the doors of the Humvees.
Yep. Parents
but
had a...
We can get $20.2 billion. It just kind of makes you wonder. Good news for the folks. The Bread and Circus crowd, the American Idiot and Cheetos crowd. Bristol Palin has come out with a new book. It's called Not Afraid of Life, My Journey So Far, which, again, you know, I'm kind of going, well, what's a 19, 20-year-old girl know so far that I want to read her memoir? And here's my problem with this. My problem is she didn't even write the damn book. She had a ghostwriter write the book, a woman named Nancy French. She is also the author of Home and Away, a story of family in a time of war, and Red State of Mind, how a catfish queen rejected the Liberty Bell. She's the one who wrote the Bristol Palin book, Not Afraid of Life. And basically, for those of you who may be interested, here's what it is. I'll get to the underlying parts right away, because that's all that's interesting. That's all that's any interest of anyone. Look, she got drunk, she got knocked up, book over. I mean, that's it. I mean, you know, so, okay, we're going to kind of do the whole, fluff, a little of this. Oh, I was on Dancing with the Stars. Oh, you know, this and that, a whole bunch of nonsense. At the end of the day, and all anybody wants to know, she got drunk on wine coolers and she got knocked up. End of game. She's saying, well, you know, I made a mistake and now I'm going to... Yeah, because that's what any person would do. Not every person who gets knocked up as a teenager gets a memoir. They don't get their own ghostwriter to write a book for them to get them hundreds of thousands of dollars in right-wing cash so that they can hire someone to raise their child. Sorry, I'm just not feeling it for you, honey. At the end of the day, the message that's being sent is my problem, is that it's okay. You know, it's okay to go get drunk in wine coolers. And look, when I was a teenager, drunken with wine coolers all the time. Loves wine coolers, especially the 2-liter bottle of Sun Country wine coolers that they don't even make anymore. And you know what? As a 15, 16-year-old, I could walk into the store and buy those, which is why I'm not in favor of privatizing the liquor stores in this state. Because I don't want my daughter, who will be 15 at some point in the very near future, to be able to walk into a store and say, I'm going to buy me some wine coolers and I'm going to go get knocked up. Sorry. Teenagers, alcohol, not a good mix. They either crash cars or get knocked up. That's the reality. So glorifying this girl, to me, just makes no sense whatsoever. She has not, and I'm sorry, oh, you sound sexist. She has not lived the existence that, say, my mother did, that had me when she was 16. My mother was not given a book deal that somebody else wrote for her. My mother actually had to go to work for herself. Didn't have someone else doing her work for her, writing her own book. I mean, isn't that just absolutely amazing? It's my memoir, but I have a ghostwriter who's writing it. What kind of a society have we become? Anyway, there's a whole bunch of made-up stuff in there. Oh, I had a cat fight with Meghan McCain. Oh, and I look at this and I go, who in their right mind in this day and age would buy this crappy book and spend as much time as I've spent talking about this?
You mean you're not going out and buying one tomorrow?
You couldn't give me this book. The only thing I would do with it is burn it in my fireplace to keep warm in the wintertime.
Well, you never know when you're going to need it.
It is not even worth the trees that we're burning down, we're cutting down to make it. I mean, really, honestly, you stop and think about this. Do I really care that Levi Johnson cheated on her about as frequently as he sharpened his hockey sticks? You mean he was sharpening his pencil as often as he was sharpening his skates? Well, gee golly whiz. Show me one teenage boy that isn't like that. Jeez, oh man. And somebody's going to read this damn thing, and I hope it's not my daughter. We're going to take a quick break right back after this.
This is why we fight, why we lie awake. This is why we fight.
Finally, radio for the rest of us. Rick Smith.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make it, we make it happen.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's
That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Now to find out what's going on in Washington, D.C., our good friend Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for us.
Glad to.
Big news out of the Supreme Court today.
Yes, indeed. The Supreme Court overturned a California ban on violent video game sales or rentals to kids. It upheld a 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals decision that ruled that the law violated minors' rights under the First Amendment. Justice Antonin Scalia, writing for the court in a 7-2 ruling, no doubt a state possesses legitimate power to protect children from harm, but that does not include a free-floating power to restrict the ideas to which children may be exposed.
I'll tell you, It's rare that I side with this court, but to be honest, I think that's the parents' job. And you know, you go through and you look at, you know, some of the, where does it end? Do we stop with books, records, what? So what I found out about this are the two people who were the dissenting votes.
Well, it's very interesting. Justice Breyer and Justice Thomas dissenting together. Breyer basically saying, what sense does it make to forbid selling to a 13-year-old boy a magazine with an image of a nude woman while protecting the sale to that 13-year-old of an interactive video game in which he actively but virtually binds and gags the woman, then tortures and kills her.
Well, there is a there is a good argument there. But at the
it's
end,
a very good argument.
Absolutely. And at the end of the day, I'm still on the side of parental, the parents, making sure that that stuff stays out of the hand, or at least I hope. Also, they overturned a campaign finance law?
Yeah, they overturned an Arizona campaign finance law that basically allowed money to go to give extra cash to publicly funded candidates who face privately funded rivals and independent groups. This was a 5-4, once again, yet another 5-4, court's conservative majority upending a campaign finance law. Now, this law was passed in the wake of a public corruption scandal and was intended to reward candidates who forego raising campaign cash, even in the face of opponents' heavy spending fueled by private money. But the court said the law violates the First Amendment.
You know, again, you look at this and, you know, what's it going to do to the areas that already have some publicly funded language? What's it going to do to New York, for instance?
It's going to be very interesting. You know, I think for anybody who's in favor of any kind of campaign finance law, it's not good.
No, I'm in favor of publicly funded elections. Get the corporate special interest cash out of it, and let's talk about ideas again instead of who can just raise the most money. Not only did they decide on a couple of cases, they also decided to take a couple of cases.
Yeah, one interesting case that they're going to take is about whether police need a warrant before using a GPS system to track a suspect's movements. They're going to hear the Obama administration's appeal of a court ruling that favored a criminal defendant. The Federal Appeals Court in Washington overturned a criminal conviction because the police had no warrant for the GPS device they secretly installed on a man's car. Other appeals courts have said search warrants are not necessary for GPS tracking. So the Justice Department argued that warrantless use of GPS devices does not violate the Fourth Amendment's ban on unreasonable searches. And it also said prompt resolution of the divergent court opinions is critically important to law enforcement.
I'm going to guess 5-4 in favor of law enforcement being able to use GPSs without a warrant.
Well, I mean, they're just going to hear it so far, so we'll see which way that one goes next session.
Yeah, next term. But I'm betting that the conservative majority will be in favor. I'm not. I think you should have to get a warrant, but that's, you know.
No, I think that's the way they're probably going to come down on that. No, it seems to me there's nearly always a friendly judge around.
Sure. I mean, it's just a phone call away usually.
Yeah. Generally speaking.
Let's talk about the big story, the debt limit. Last week it came out. Cantor stormed out of the room in a well-staged, well-planned event. Where are we now with the debt talks?
The president met this morning with the Senate Majority Leader, Harry Reid. And they strategized. It was interesting, in the press briefing this afternoon, Secretary Jay Carney came out and was talking about how it's very important that we get a deal. A balanced approach was the phrase he kept using. He kept talking about the middle class and seniors. And he kept talking about millionaires and billionaires. Corporate jets was one of the things he was talking about, and oil and gas subsidies. So I imagine that's what they were talking about during the meeting, and that's the new meme, because that was something that was talked about towards the end of last week after Eric Cantor walked out. So that's clearly going to be something that they're going to be pushing now, the Democrats, that this is what the Republicans are in favor of, is those tax breaks for corporate jets.
Right.
So that was one meeting. Then there was another meeting at 5 o'clock this afternoon with Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, which is also to get the debt talks started again. And it's very important that we do get those debt talks started again, because August the 2nd is starting to get a little bit closer all the time.
Yeah, I find it interesting. Last week it was the kind of between millionaires and poor people. That was the thing. Republicans figured that didn't work. Now I'm seeing talks of between millionaires, siding with millionaires or the military, because I've seen some people saying, well, we might want to look at cutting something in the Pentagon. So, when I see this, I'm going, we're going to protect the millionaires and billionaires instead of the country? Is that the...
Well, they are talking about that. Well, there is an awful lot of pork in the Pentagon, and Robert Gates, the Secretary of Defense, who's about to retire, has said himself, yeah, you can cut the Pentagon. He has said that himself. So it's not as though there aren't places for cutting, and the Tea Party freshmen don't feel the same way about the defense budget that some of the more long-time Republicans, more hawkish Republicans, who feel that it's sacrosanct,
right,
to not cut the defense budget. And it may be that they, in fact, do find ways of compromising on this thing by going after some items in the defense budget. But whether that means that they don't go after the tax issue at all, it remains to be seen.
Yeah, again, it's just interesting to me, because your first club out of the bag is go after the poor people. Second club, go after the military. The millionaires and billionaires way down the list of the clubs pulling out of the bag. I guess Michelle Bachmann announced her run for the presidency and then quickly put her foot in her mouth.
She was very careful. She really hasn't put her foot in her mouth. She was so careful with what she said. She was almost murmuring. Well, that's an exaggeration, because she gave a stirring speech. But they've hired Ed Rollins, who's a very clever political strategist. So that was quite a clever move. And she's being made over. She's being Stepford-wifed into sort of a mainstream Republican candidate.
Did you hear this clip on one of the local news stations there in Iowa?
Well, what I want them to know is, just like John Wayne was from Waterloo, Iowa, that's just the kind of spirit that I have, too.
From Waterloo?
Yes.
I'm just kind of looking at, listening to that going, it wasn't John Wayne, it was John Wayne Gacy. So I'm assuming we're going to see clown masks and clown makeup everywhere from now until she's elected. She's never going to live this down.
This was unfortunate, a little unfortunate, in the same way that she's also said that the president has released all the oil from the Strategic Reserve. He's actually released 4% of the oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve.
4%? All of it? What's the difference? You're just talking about numbers.
I'm quibbling over 96%. That's all I'm doing.
Well, I mean, the rest of the Republican field, kind of interesting as well. I guess we got some other good news from the other seven dwarfs, if you will.
Well, we had a poll out. Mitt Romney's polling at 23%. She's at 22%. John Huntsman is polling at 2%. So that's always interesting. Not for him, though.
No.
I don't think he's too happy. And, in fact, he's been excoriated in Politico, who did a piece on him. It turns out he's disliked by very wealthy Mormon donors, which I can confirm. He also speaks so quietly he can't be heard. He gets tired easily. He's a supporter of civil unions, and air conditioners give him bronchitis. I'm just repeating what they said. I have no judgment here.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
That's the guy I want in the White House. Although I would take him over Sarah Palin any day.
Well, she is heading to Iowa. She may even be there with her husband, Todd, because the new very favorable documentary on her has its premiere in Iowa tomorrow.
Oh, boy. Can't wait to see that. I'm hoping someone sends me a hijacked copy of it. Chris Christie in the news as well?
Chris Christie says the person who picked me as a vice president would have to be sedated. He says he's not vice presidential material.
Well, at least he's honest. I don't think any of the field is vice presidential material, and I definitely believe none of them are presidential material.
Well, and I'm sure that the Republicans feel the same way about you.
And on that, we will end it. Victoria Jones, thank you so much, Talk Radio News Service. Always great talking with you.
Thank you.
All right. Now, what do we got going on across the street, Jake?
Thanks, Rick. Some breaking news, some good news out of Wisconsin. A Republican rep in Wisconsin has been disqualified from a recall ballot. In a major development in the Wisconsin recall elections, the state's governmental counter board today ruled Representative John Newgren, one of two Republicans who filed to challenge Democratic Senator Dave Hansen, is disqualified from the ballot for lack of adequate signatures. To legally appear in the ballot, Newgren was required to submit about 400 valid signatures. He submitted 400. In fact, he submitted 424, but the GAB has ruled that only 398, too short of the required number, was valid. Before his disqualifications, Newgren had enjoyed the full backing of the Republican Party of Wisconsin and the committee to elect the Republican Senate. Now, here's the funny part. The Republicans, upon finding that out, went out and found someone else to run. Listen to this guy's qualifications. Hansen will now face David Landerlest, who, according to Wisconsin news media, has a court record of two misdemeanor convictions, fines for multiple building code violations, an unpaid judgment, bankruptcy, and a home foreclosure in a July 19th general election. Hansen had previously been considered one of two vulnerable Democrats facing recall on August 16th. This is great news for the Democrats. It gives them an even better chance of regaining control of the Senate, and I think they have a real good chance of doing exactly that. AP story coming out, it seems that the ex-governor of Illinois, Governor Blagojevich, has been convicted of trying to sell Obama's seat, his senatorial seat. The verdict was a bitter defeat for Blagojevich, who had spent about 2.5 years professing his innocence on reality TV shows and later on the witness stand. His defense team had insisted that hours of FBI wiretapping recordings were just the ramblings of a politician who liked to think out loud. Now, to that end, I saw several interviews of jurors on a national TV station during the day, and several of them said that on several of the state tapes, Blagojevich offered a quid pro quo for the Senate seat, and that it went far beyond thinking out loud like his defense attorneys had claimed. Blagojevich, in fact, is the second straight Illinois governor that's going to serve time. If convicted, he could serve.
He's been convicted.
Well, that's true. He has been convicted, but he could serve.
He'll be professing his innocence.
He hasn't been sentenced yet. They claim he could serve as much as 300 years, but you know how the guidelines go. He'll probably serve some of them concurrently, but I guarantee you, he will be away for a good number of years. It's amazing. This guy, I just saw his interview. He just got sentenced. He, you know, good chance that a good part of his life he'll spend.
You mean he just was found guilty?
He was found guilty, and he's there talking to the press as if it was another interview. This guy's amazing. He's absolutely amazing.
Because he's not going right to jail. He'll be able to appeal. There's a whole process in all this.
No, the man's got serious problems. This seems to be a Judgment Day. Another AP story. This involves Bill DeWeese and his bonus gate trial. A state judge says he expects to decide by the end of the week whether to move Bill DeWeese's public corruption trial from Harrisburg to his home district in southwestern Pennsylvania, Greene County. Judge Barry Fidel laid out the timetable after an hour-long hearing today regarding DeWeese's effort to move the location of his trial and charges. He misused his public office for campaign purposes. He is charged with conflict of interest, conspiracy, and three counts of theft in the bonus gate legislative corruption case. DeWeese says a trial in Waynesboro would be easier on his witnesses and save Dauphin County from the expense and logistic hassle of another proceeding in the Attorney General's long-standing investigation of the legislature. Now, we all know that he believes that if he can have a home trial in the home park, so to speak, it'll be to his advantage. Now, Mr. DeWeese is one of three or four key, very powerful politicians that have either been sent to prison or have been brought up on corruption charges. Senator Fumo, several years ago, was brought up, was actually convicted on federal charges. He's serving about a five-year sentence. In fact, there was a huge outcry from the prosecutors. They thought that he should have gotten a lot more. But in fact, Senator Fumo is still in prison. Mike Vian is serving 6 to 14 years. In addition to that, he's going to be brought up on additional charges. And then you have John Purcell, who is a very powerful Republican, whose trial has still not come up. So stay tuned on that, Andrew. Rick, that's my report.
All righty, we're going to take a quick break. Right back to wrap this up.
Thought-provoking, opinionated. Rick Smith.
On July 5, 1935, the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law. It is also known as the Wagner Act after its chief sponsor, New York Senator Robert Wagner. Prior to its passage, Senator Wagner chaired the National Labor Board, created by Franklin Roosevelt in 1933 to attempt to bring order to labor-management relations. The National Labor Board consisted of three representatives from labor and three from industry, with Wagner as the chairman. It was here that Senator Wagner realized government assistance was required to level the playing field if labor unions were to effectively bargain with management. President Roosevelt said of the National Labor Relations Act, "It should serve as an important step toward the achievement of just and peaceful labor relations and industry." Hailed as the Magna Carta of labor, once the National Labor Relations Act was signed into law, workers were encouraged and protected to exercise their newly recognized rights to freedom of association, self-organization, and engage in concerted activities for the purpose of collectively bargaining through a representative of their own choosing in order to establish wages, hours, and conditions. Employer interference, such as threats and intimidation, firing, refusing to negotiate with the union, and discrimination for union activity were expressly prohibited. These illegal activities are described as unfair labor practices by the law. The impact of the Wagner Act on American life was substantial. The standard of living for American workers, their families, and communities was extraordinary. Unionization rates increased to a high of 35% of the American workforce as American workers demanded their rights. Working men and women finally had a unified voice to stand up and fight for dignity, respect, and safety in their workplace. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Your Working Class Radio Experience. Where hard work, common sense, and rational thoughts are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Working hard to make a living. Reaching out from the red. Father, son, left the candy on. Blue devil.
working class.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, right there for your entertainment, your enjoyment. You can download our podcast. Take it with you on the go. As I said earlier, soon we're going to have our Stitcher app up and running. So people can download it on their smartphones. Take it with you wherever you go. Also, if you want to contact me, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. So good times ahead. Again, this budget thing, I can't get over the video our governor put up. The governor unplugged. Kind of makes me laugh, you know, like on so many levels. But, you know, the reality is again, all of this money that has come in new revenue, all of these taxes that we've collected, all this additional revenue, just a blip. It's just a blip. But again, that blip could help people. Could stave off some of the draconian, drastic, painful cuts that this governor is proposing. Don't know if you saw the big news, but Mayor Bloomberg of New York City is, the consummate entrepreneur. He is starting the NYC I Do campaign, going to make New York City the gay wedding destination of the nation. He said he's hoping to estimate that the state would earn about $400 million over the next 3 years from gay and lesbian couples getting married. So again, you know, taking advantage of what you can. That works. In Florida, Governor Rick Scott is the nation's least popular governor, but he has no intention of changing course, according to an interview with the Wall Street Journal, remaining unfazed by criticism or polls that most Floridians consider his draconian budget cuts and privatization of Medicaid unfair and a bridge too far. And look, you know, the radical right understands. They understand that, you know, they're going to be taken care of. The wealth class will take care of them. The Rick Scott's already wildly wealthy, already a multi-millionaire, quite possibly a billionaire in his own right. Scott Walker, he will be taken care of. Kasich will be taken care of. Look, you know, as radical as they can be, that's feathers in their cap. So, you know, that's kind of the interesting point of all this. Our tweet of the day comes from Matt Briette from the Commonwealth Foundation. Wisconsin is throwing more education lifelines to kids. Will PA? They want us to be like Wisconsin in their education. They want us to be like Texas. Just some radical stuff going on. Anyway, I just got the finger, which means I've got a minute to wrap this up. Again, I want to thank our guests for coming on the program. You know, it's always good to talk to John Logan from the San Francisco State University about this Boeing case. Because, as he pointed out, it's a zero-sum game, but the middle class loses more. And it's not about what the right is pushing. It's not against right to work versus non-right to work. It's not against North versus South. It's against an employer who has chosen to break the law. Again, if you missed any portion of the program, just go to thericksmithshow.com. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Have a great night. We'll be back here tomorrow. Maybe there will be a budget tomorrow that we can rail against. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray. Democracy is coming.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.